me that it's sometime soon.
There we go. We're recording.
We're recording while we're waiting for a table.
We're waiting for a table at Steamworks in Durango.
Sunday before 4th of July.
Right. So
this is excellent.
Welcome there's a lot. Yeah. This is the best we could do it at 8 o'clock on Sunday night. So I'm talking with, why don't you introduce yourself? I love when other people do.
Okay, my name is Josh Ogle. I run Josh Ogle Design LLC, which makes Ogle Component Design parts under my own brand. And then I also do design and engineering for a few other bicycle companies, Firefly, Rita, and just recently did a project with Merlin.
Excellent. That's stuff I want to talk to you about. I sent you a text earlier today. I want to talk to you about design, CAD, and CAM.
Yes.
And those are things you are intimately familiar with.
I've been doing all of those things for 25 plus years.
Yikes.
Which is bananas when I think about it. It's a half a lifetime, and one day I'll get good at it.
Well, they're cool problems, though. That's the thing.
It's, well, you know what I love about it?
If you can you speak up? By the way, Josh is just getting over bronchitis, so it's tough for him right now, but he's doing it.
I'm doing what I can, yeah. What was the question?
Oh, the question was, could you speak up a bit?
Okay.
Just if you can.
Oh, yeah, we're talking about cool problems, and then, I mean, I love, like, it's, you know, each one of them is its own little world of knowledge. You know, there's, like, the whole, you know, there's the world of design, there's the world of machining, or, you know, there's the world of, I mean, there's, like, you know, I mean, there's three parts to it, or maybe that's even simplifying too much, but it's like, when I design my own stuff, I know exactly what the constraints are because I know how it's going to be made. So it makes my designing super fucking simple because I know I'm in charge of the process from concept to execution. When I design for other people, when other people ask me to machine their designs, that there's always more hang-ups in that process, because it's like, you know, either people want stuff that, you know, they send me stuff with sharp inside corners, which obviously, you know, as you know,
right,
cannot be cut, which people just love to do regardless, or people ask me to design stuff that I wouldn't make for myself, but, you know, I gotta swallow that, you know, that has nothing to do with it. They want a product, I can make them the product, I just gotta figure it out to make them something that they want that I think is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I had to do that a bit. I mean, we both share having done work for Firefly.
Yeah.
And
which is a hell of a fucking name to be able to drop.
Yeah, it's a pretty sick drop, but I think the stuff that you've done with them is certainly the number of parts, but also the complexity and certainly the level of design that you brought to it is different. I mean, I think, you know, Josh and I have spoken, I'm speaking to the audience. I'll speak to the audience periodically here, just because there's some contextualization. But Josh and I have spoken previously about our approaches. And essentially, I want to make weapons, Josh wants to make jewelry. And there's kind of in a way, our perspective on what we're trying to get done. And like Josh has made jewelry, he's made his watches and things like that, which are amazingly intricate.
I almost wore one today.
Yeah, you almost wore one. And like, you know, I've worked on guns, you know, and motorcycles and stuff like that. Not that Josh hasn't worked on motor vehicles too. But
no, I'm actually mentoring a gunsmith.
Oh, really? That's
I've actually been brazing old fucking muzzle loaders.
Oh, muzzle loaders!
It's crazy. Like
talking with gun people is crazy. I thought there was nothing more basic than skateboarders.
Oh, no.
But then I started chatting with gun people, and I was like, wow, this is almost skateboard level type thinking.
It's kind of crazy. Like, really, like, this guy's like a reputable gunsmith.
Right.
And I don't want to say anything. I mean, he's a very cool person. He just doesn't know anything about the machining end of it.
Sure.
Like, this is not to disparage him in any way. He's like, you know, everything I tell him, he seems to just suck in with one hearing. He understands it and puts it to use.
Yeah.
But it's wild. Like, the minimal level of machining, that goes into most of this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, way back in the day, I went to an auction at Dan Wesson Firearms in Massachusetts, which was a very fancy name at the time, and got to walk through their production facility during an auction. And it's just horizontal mills and shapers for a lot of that stuff. And
all of it. Yep,
that's where most of the gun industry's always been. And let's talk about design. I want to kind of focus here because, you know, I talk to people about a lot of things. A lot of people cut metal, but the thing is, when it comes to design, working with CAD and doing CAM, among the people that I work with in bicycling, you're at the premier end of that.
Wow, thank you so much.
No, you are. I mean, no one could argue that. Right?
I'm sure plenty of people would try.
They could try.
Based on my history, but thank you nonetheless.
And you're doing it in titanium.
Well, that's the goal. I mean, that's why I was lucky to be in the watch industry for a while, is that it's like it taught me how to finish tie to a level that nobody else in the bike industry was doing at the time. I mean, there's a couple of guys that are really trying to do like intricate titanium parts now. And I, you know, I'm hoping some of that is based on my, you know, my trying to take it to the next level.
Yeah, well, it's very hard because, I mean, you know, I speak very well of Mark at Paragon, who would be the reference that we'd all use. And the thing is, it's like what Mark does that's so amazing is he survives.
Oh, yeah.
He makes a living. And very few people can do that. And what he has to do that means he can't attempt to achieve the finishes you're trying to.
Right.
And survive. And the thing is, that's a big difference. And it's like, how do we do that?
The trick is the volume. You know what I mean? There's always going to be room at the very, very top for shit that's made that fucking well.
And how many pieces are being consumed that can afford that?
Exactly. I make a few hundred sets of lock rings a year.
Right.
You know, that's not a lot by any standard.
It's not going to come anywhere near to pay his monthly rent.
Exactly. You know? And the thing is, he's supporting several people.
Oh, dude.
Like, that's the amazing thing.
No, he's got
like,
a big crew.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's the amazing thing. You know, it's like his, you know, he's grown throughout all of it, through all the ups and downs of the industries, from fucking day one of mountain biking to today. He's been through all of it.
So
he's like, he doesn't, so he's, the thing is, he knows his parts aren't gonna go wrong. Like, that's the thing. It's like, he knows.
No, they have to be bomber.
Exactly. Well, no, not just bomber, but
not bomber durability, bomber manufacturing. Right. He has to be able to take it out of stock in the cheapest way possible. He needs to process it in ways that are fast, because that's the only way. Look at the pricing. How do you do that? Right? So anyway, but we're talking about a different level of design here, where like you're shaping things, you know, like jewelry, like it's a watch. What's up there?
Sorry, our table's ready.
Okay, so we're going to cut here and pick up back again when we are at a table.
On surface finishes.
On surface finishes and all that. Here we go. Can you talk?
Yeah, sure.
Just talk right now, like say something.
I'm saying things.
Okay, good. Okay, we're back. We're inside. We ordered our food, and currently Formula One race is in front of us. So that's pretty cool for both of us.
It is a very, it's always a good night when you're watching Formula One. Why don't you put that on there?
Oh, yeah, that's totally cool. All right, there we go. We're using a ketchup bottle as a prop. So you were talking about... Just, we've sidebarred into surface finishing and the cost associated with that when making parts.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's what I was going to say. Like, that's why it's, you know, at Mark's level, you know, he gets a decent finish, but, you know, he has a whole finishing department.
Right.
You know, the level that...
Well, he's also never using a ball end mill, certainly not on titanium.
Well, this is true, but I mean, yeah, and especially not a 32nd inch ball end all day long on titanium.
Right, right.
I mean, I could probably make my parts 20 or 25% faster if I didn't do any kind of really cosmetic finishing, but...
But that's not what you're doing. But
exactly. You know, that doesn't, you know, that's one of the ways that, you know, I really feel like my stuff stands out, is that it's like, it's amazing to look at. You know what I mean? It's like, there's a lot of people making really great parts now, but it's like, I want to make something that's just that level beyond. Like,
well, you've always been that way, right? I mean, you've always wanted to take your stuff to the premium, the maximum you could do, I think.
Well, I think that's the key, is I always wanted to do that, and now I'm finally doing that.
Sure.
Like, since I was messing around with the watches, that was just like the, why am I not doing it the fucking way I want to? Why am I not doing it to that level? And that was where that big shift came in. That was right around the same time the Firefly guys asked me to, you know, cut some parts for them. And I was just like, yeah, let me... You know, I finished everything off with an actual, like, a really high-end titanium finisher, and they're like, yeah, dude, we don't have to do anything after we get your parts.
Right.
Like, we just weld them and then put our regular finish on. There's no prep work.
Right.
And that made me really happy, because it's just like, you know, that's, I think that goes along with their whole, that goes along with their, what's the word I'm looking for?
Clean look?
But yeah, I mean, just it's everything that they do is so crisp. You know.
Well,
what I mean?
What's like, interesting is like the fork just dropped, and that's been in the works for a while. I couldn't talk about it when I was doing the Firefly interview.
Yeah.
With Tyler there.
Yeah.
But you know, I was looking at pictures of that fork, and it's stellar. It looks gorgeous.
Thank you.
And it's special. But I was noticing the dropout, the printed dropout break area.
Yeah.
And the blend into the tube is fucking crazy. And I want to see what the print side looks like.
How do you mean?
It looks like there's no weld there.
Oh, yeah. They just, so...
And the thing is, they aren't guys that are known for grinding away weld. And I'm wondering, it's like, are we working with some fussy stuff where you've got fusions, you've got built-up material, you're using consumable prints, things like that. How are you essentially making a cavity-free, probably not ground-clean blend like that? I was questioning it. I was like, how is he doing it? But we'll see, maybe tomorrow.
My understanding, I mean, I'll show you the prints. It's literally just a square edge. It's a butt joint.
It's just a butt.
It's just a freaking butt joint. And Tyler basically grinds both edges a little bit and just pumps a bunch of heat and a ton of filler wire in.
Really? Wow.
And, yeah, and then all the finishing that they do on it, they don't do any mechanical finishing. They just do Scotch-Brite.
That is amazing.
It's wild.
I'm stunned because it doesn't look that way when you look at it.
And it's single pass.
Jesus.
Sorry, there might be a fusion pass, but the actual fill pass, single pass.
Okay, so let's talk about design.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to bring us back because there's so much we can talk about.
Oh, yeah. No, the design is, yeah. I get real off track when I'm talking to you because we have such deep history.
Right.
You know,
it's like
we can talk about all the different shit.
Right, I'm trying to keep this focused and what people I think would love to hear you talk about. Because, okay, like design, you talked earlier, before we came into the restaurant, about working for other people. It's not about you. It's not what you want. And I experienced that. I did work with Drew. I did work with Firefly. I did work with Independent Fabrications and some other folks where it's like, oh, I didn't want to do a plate dropout. But they wanted to do a plate dropout. I was
so
over plate dropouts.
Exactly,
and so you do one. And it's like, oh, you throw them a couple concepts and they're like, no, I don't like those. Can you go like this? And I'm like, really? Or whatever. Or I didn't think of that. Or please don't make me do that. Don't do that. And so we end up with these struggles.
Actually, excuse me?
Hey, bro.
You can actually get a ginger ale, some lime.
Ginger ale with lime, yeah.
Thanks, man. Because I'm classy.
Yes, you are. But yeah, you end up in these positions where it's their product. It's going on their bike. It has their name on it. And they are, you know, they're either paying or they're doing favors or whatever the deal is worked out. Or whatever. Okay. Whatever the deal is.
Yeah.
Because it's always a deal. And like, but the thing is, it's like, it's their dropout, not your dropout. And that put me especially in an interesting position because most of my work is, it's so about me. It's about what I want.
Right.
But I had to step out of that working for these folks. And I learned some things. I learned just how to swallow it. I learned how to think about them and all that stuff and produce. And that was interesting. And you're talking about that as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's... The great thing about working with Firefly is that they're amazing collaborators. It's like, I give them an idea, and they say yes, they say no, and like we kind of go back and forth.
And, like, do the parts end up exactly the way I want? No, but they're not my parts. They're their parts.
Right.
You know? I mean, they like very clean stuff. I tend to be more... You know, I like fucking wild gothic Batman shenanigans. Like,
yeah,
this lug set that I'm working on is gonna knock.
Yeah, yours is a lot messier than what they end up with.
Yeah, and I don't mind the word messy. It's just there's.
Right, it's not a disparagement. It's messy. There's a lot more going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, people have said, like, the watches, people use the word steampunk, which I didn't really like. To me, steampunk is actually messy.
I wouldn't call yours steampunk at all.
Well, neither
your watches were blocky.
Well, but it was the titanium and the brass and the exposed hardware, and it's like all these things that people associate with steampunk, but steampunk to me, that's messy.
Yeah, I'm sure you use very little brass.
Well, yeah, it's just the crown guard.
Right,
well,
so...
And, yeah, but it was just something...
If you're under 50% brass, is it steampunk?
No, not at all, but my point was that, like, you know, people use the word steampunk very loosely.
Sure.
But, like, it's not that I like... It's, I mean, I'm really stuck on the word messy, and it's not that I like... It's not messy, it's that I like it to show what it does. Like, I like things that show you what they do, like, where the strength goes. Like, you know, like those NASA tanks where they machine them, and you can, like, the webbing is all on the outside so you can see what it does.
Sure.
Like, the new tank that they machine for the, what's the new, not Ares.
Altris? Anyway.
That one.
Yeah. They're going to Mars.
Yeah. No, not
that
none
one.
Of that
Different
fucking
one.
Guy.
No. There's a NASA vehicle that's going to Mars, right? That's
now?
Not.
There's a new one?
Anyway, well, let's not derail.
Okay. Point being, I love exposed structure, like things that show you what they do. I like the opposite of carbon. You know what I mean?
The opposite of what?
Of modern carbon design, where everything is smoothed out and hidden, and it just all blends together.
Right.
I like stuff that shows you what it does. That's what attracted me to watches. It's like all the exposed casework and metalwork, and you know. So it's like my design tends to be more ornate to make you feel your way through it as you're looking at it.
Right.
You know, the Firefly guys, they're design comes in the finishing, and, like, you know, they love, like, I love what they let me do with their parts.
And it's ultra clean.
Exactly.
Right.
But they can get as wild as they want with the finishes, and it's still a beautiful, clean design.
Sure.
Like, that's a great thing, you know?
Right.
I think them calming...
Like, without any finishes, you know it's a Firefly.
Exactly. And I think them calming down my more aggressive instincts in design was amazing for them.
Right.
Like, that was a great thing that I was able to hear that and be like, yeah, I'm going to make you the part that you want.
Like, when I'm designing, I'm not clean. I'm also not trying to make it ornate. I'm strictly by the numbers. I feel like that's my sort of... I want it to do what it needs to do, and anything more than that is, in my mind, wrong for me, and I want to take it away.
So here's the thing, though. I've been thinking about this a lot, because we've had discussions about this. And you're within numbers within your chosen medium and writing style. So it's like within like, you know.
I'm not doing aerodynamics in any way.
Right. But I mean, there still are design, I don't know why that sounds so weird. You still do design flourishes, but you keep them very minimal.
I did a yoke a while back. It was a clamshell machine yoke, and I designed a flourish into it where there was no need for that to exist in it. And it was this wild, outside-of-the-box thing for me. And I haven't done it since, knowingly, I guess I've tried a few with the star cutouts. Hilarious engineering thing.
Yeah, which, by the way, Pete, that was a... I mean,
I know.
I don't need to rub it in, but that was a terrible design idea to put those cutouts in.
No, I know, but that's what was so crazy, because I overthink everything, and I get so in the weeds that cutouts, the whole goal was, don't overthink it. Fucking do it. Throw it and see if it works. Fuck it. Don't overthink it. But it was like, well, god damn it, it's a 6-pointed star or a 5-pointed star. Or is it 7? I can't even remember.
They were 5. And
Marin County Sheriff.
Yeah.
But the thing is, of course it's a stress riser like there's no tomorrow. But the thing is, sometimes things work that you don't know are going to work. And if you're always hedging, if you're always playing it safe, if you're always like, well, I don't see why, so I'm not gonna, you do start painting yourself in a corner that you're not going to get out of. But that's the explanation for the stars. Anyway.
which is fair. I mean, and you are your own test dummy.
Oh, boy, am I.
Well, exactly. You know, and it's like, for me, you know, you're not making, you haven't been making parts for production. By the way, the brake adapters look amazing.
Oh, my God, I can't wait.
I can't wait to see those. But, you know, I'm, you know, at the very, very high end, I have to think about all of those things.
Sure.
You know, like, as a design thing, it's like, yeah, my craziest shit does have to be reined in somewhat.
Right.
Because what happens when it breaks?
Right.
Where does it break, and how do you make sure it fails in a safe manner, you know?
It's, absolutely. No, certainly I wouldn't take risks doing stuff that I was going to be selling to anybody like that. Or
yeah, and it's like, and the thing is, that's not an easy, like... You know, for
but
me,
it's the space I want to work. I want to work in works,
right.
Experimental level, like development systems.
Right, and that's
I don't want to work in again production shit.
Right, and that you know, and again that separates your whole weapon system versus my jewelry.
Sure,
you know what I mean? It's like your shit, like weapons. Yeah, sometimes they don't work. You know,
right,
I mean,
right.
How many fucking tries did it take to get the fucking F-35 working? You know, that takes how many billions of dollars? But it works. It's
right.
Badass. You know.
Right. Well, how about this? Okay, let's shift a little bit and go toward still within the design world. Let's say Firefly said to you, like, "Oh, we want to do a new fork end, and it's going to be post mount, not flat mount, and you know, we want to do 15 millimeter through axle, and it's going to be an aggressive fork, right?" So you'd have to start that design process, and certainly you've laid some groundwork. But like, what sort of, how do you sort implement a design? How do you get it going? Because the first couple iterations within the CAD,
yeah,
for me
are always garbage.
They're always garbage, and you're churning through ideas. You're going in directions, and you say, "No, that's definitely wrong," or "I like something here, but something's not right." How do you set up?
I mean, so
your design?
My first thing is just connecting the points.
Right.
The first model just connects point A to point B to point C.
Fundamental geometry.
Exactly. Fundamental geometries. And then...
Okay. Let's see. It's still going.
Okay. My first model is just the absolute most basic fundamental geometry. And then I print those out and I stick them on the wall and I walk away from them. That's the reality of it. Like, I did, you know, I get the design out there and then I say, yeah, I don't want anything to do with this for a little while. And
the clearing of the mind.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, cool, now it's down. And I can, as I walk by it and I look at it, it's like, you know, I get these ideas. And when it's like I have a few ideas, and I'll sit back down, spend a few hours, and do some iterations.
Sure.
You know, and that way I'll get like one or two, you know, and of course, you know, like I'll go a little bit farther than I mean to go, then I'll have to draw it back. And,
right.
You know, and periodically, like, you know, with Firefly, I don't have any problem. Like, I know they're so amazing. Like, they're such amazing guys. Like, I'll send them unfinished models to be like, what do you guys think about this direction?
Right.
You know, like, a lot of companies, a lot of people that I've worked with, I can't do that. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, I just don't trust them.
Can they give you the ruthless critique?
I like to think that they do.
Okay.
I mean, I'm
a big fan of ruthless criticism, and like, I mean, I want to hear what's bad, what's good.
I mean,
I don't want it to be like, well, I see what you're doing, blah, blah, blah. No, it's like, it sucks or it doesn't, you know?
Well,
that's what I like.
I think the parts that we've done together, okay. They've, we've pretty much... Yeah. The parts that we've done together, they've pretty much, we've had a, you know, we've discussed the vision of what the part is ahead of time. Like, the fork was the most out there thing that we've done.
Yeah.
You know, the basically aside.
That's a whole different thing.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't, like, that was where we had a ton of fucking freedom to do what we wanted to do. You know, like, stem parts, there really wasn't a whole, like, the C-collar was great.
It's
like,
more,
you know,
a dress-up kit
exactly.
At that point. But this is a real thing.
Yeah, so there's only so many ways it could really be done.
Right.
You know, like, that was the thing. It's like, they had a very specific idea in their minds of, like, we want to use this blade, we want to use this steer, you know, we want to use, you know, titanium tubing for the blades, we want to use a carbon steer. You know, let's connect those points to the fork tips and let's do it, you know.
Right.
And the nice thing is, you know, I got to sit down and be like, if I was going to make this fork for myself, like, I'm like, we, you know, I've become very risk averse in my, you know, in my old, like, you know, like I started to say before, we do a lot of testing and stuff like that.
So it's like, what happens when this breaks? Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know.
Well, I think for the kinds of stuff we work on, and you work on motor cars, you work on the bicycles, you work. I mean, the watches are a little different, but like when you're around real equipment, any real designer is planning for the failure.
The failure, exactly.
And what's going to happen. Exactly. And even if you're trying to be out at the bleeding edge like I am, and I've had some spectacular failures recently, and I'm lucky, but the thing is...
Your teeth look good.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is that... In most cases, you're like, well, what's the fail safe? How is it going to fail? And are you going to ride it out? Or are you going to at least ditch it softly or something like that?
I don't know if you saw my post about the fork. Like, they didn't even talk about the whole steer tube design.
Right.
Like, one thing, like, I was like, look, I don't like bonded steer tubes.
Okay.
Just not a fucking fan. Dissimilar metals. There's so much that can go wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Especially
yeah.
with the printed part where you don't have a consistent surface, where there's so much going on.
And then carbon. Yeah.
But, you know, I was like, look, if you guys want to do a carbon steer tube, here's my idea. You can't plug it in from the top because that way it can come out from the top. It has to go in from the bottom. And if we make it an oval, it can't rotate. So worst case scenario, that bond just completely comes loose.
And it just rattles a little.
It just fucking rattles a little and you go home.
Right.
A-okay. You know?
Right.
And I don't know any other fork that's put together like that. And I told them that. I'm like, this is the baseline for what we're designing.
Right.
Like, I hope you're cool with this.
Well, I mean, a lot of that's that, okay, you're working at a scale where 3D printing makes sense.
Yeah.
And you're able to get carbon steers made the way you want. And, well, those two things lend themselves like, okay, you can make your interface as you please.
Exactly.
And it's kind of like my handlebars. I mean, I was doing carbon fiber for a while and couldn't quite get it to work, but I'm using off-the-shelf tubes.
Well, exactly.
And thing is, it's like, I wanted to use custom tubes from the start.
Right, but it's that scale of...
Unless
you're going to wind them yourself.
And it's development level shit where it's like, oh, I used that one. Now I want to change the design. Well, that's not how things are made. You need to do batches of 50, and then you're paying 50 parts for the use of two, and now you're screwed. Yeah, so the thing is, it's like I finally switched to titanium, and... Yep, thank you. Hold on, we're going to start some food here. Okay, we're back. We gobbled down food, and now we're stoked. So I was in the middle of saying, because we were talking about some failure stuff or design and changing things, but with my handlebars, I had done carbon. Oh, right.
Done carbon, then you moved to titanium.
I moved to titanium, but that was for a fail-safe, right? Because rather than having a catastrophic failure, I was expecting that at the very worst, I could have a bent bar, but it would stay integral. And what was interesting was we did a bunch of testing and measurement, and I talked to a few other people in the industry about what to use and everything like that. End up with the material I have. And it turns out the thing I really wanted when I made the carbon fiber was a lot of flex.
And you
I
got that with the titanium.
With the titanium, I got more flex than the earlier stuff that I had used that I'd already had to change a few times to try to prevent breakage. And it was getting stiffer. And now already the titanium is more flexible than the original stuff. And it's better than carbon. And I was like, oh, son of a bitch, I wish I had... I ruled this out way too early. Didn't even consider titanium, just went straight to carbon, and it's actually, titanium's actually a better, safer material. Could have even just used that from the start. It's crazy.
Funny how that works sometimes.
Yeah, you know, you just make assumptions, and it kicks your ass.
Honestly, my favorite front end on any of my bikes is going to sound totally ridiculous. I made a, you'll see it at the shop, but I have a rigid yellow single speed, completely rigid, 2-to-1 gear ratio, just an absolute knee breaker of a bike.
2-to-1 with 29-inch wheels or 26-inch wheels?
Well, 26-inch. Still a knee breaker of a bike for a 50-year-old man.
Sure.
titanium stem that Jason Grove welded for me and a straight 7/8 inch tie bar. Flexi as fuck, but it's 25 years old. It works amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it just, it you can, I have so much, like, finesse through the turns on it, and it bugs the shit out of people on suspension bikes when you're sitting on their wheel on a bike that shouldn't do any of these things.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that, I mean, I've done a lot of work with full, with rigid bikes, with hardtails, with front suspension, and not with my own full suspension bikes. Obviously, I don't have that, but with other people's, and setting them up and making them do things. And it's like, it's odd how, well, no, it's not odd. The whole industry talks about things you can buy, upgrades you can make, changes you can do that cost you money, put money in other people's pockets that are going to somehow make the difference. And it's like, no, what really makes the difference is proper geometry, proper setup. You've made a bunch of choices. Those choices aren't about money. None of the choices are about money. And that's what makes your bike fast or competent or stable. And it's none of the money decision stuff is what it really comes down to. And it's just fantastic. I mean, you're talking about it right there. It's just, you're flying through stuff. Why? The bars are hooking it up for you and making it so you can see things different.
Well, and I think it's also, there's, you know, as I'm not, I refuse to use the word makers, you know, as builder.
It's a tough word to use.
It really is now, you know. As, I mean, and I have a 3D printer, so I refuse to use the word maker. As builders, you know, we have inherent faith in what we're doing because we know it's designed to our design, to our riding criteria.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? Like, talking about, like, design stuff, it's like, I know, you know, I have, like, I want to, honestly, I looked at the Formula One race and I completely forgot where I was going. I'm so embarrassed.
Right. Well, I think what you're trying to say is we decide what's working well based on our riding and our testing and all that stuff. But, like, I've ridden with several honest to freaking God professional level downhill racers and enduro racers.
Yeah, I mean,
I mean, they're all spread
around
out.
The world,
but the thing
right,
is,
but I'm saying,
but the
you,
thing
you,
is,
you
is
have
that,
an amazing group of people to ride with in Marin that are going to challenge.
Oh, sure, but the thing is, it's like when you,
the gentleman doing okay? Any refills on your sodas or anything?
All good, thank you.
Maybe some more water, please.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
But what I'm saying is when you've ridden with honest to God professional level riders, they are using the bike on a completely different level.
Oh yeah.
And it's I cannot put the bike into the situation that they're gonna put it into. I just can't. And I can't, and then I have to imagine how it's gonna work. How is it gonna be when they just do something insane? And it's like, that's the trickier edge of the design job.
Yeah.
When you have to reach way outside what you think, I ride this section good. It's like, but, you know, I was in Santa Cruz one time with a pro rider, and we're riding some sick trail in Santa Cruz, and we come down something, and he hits this thing on the trail, and I thought it was just a lump, and 30 feet later, there's this other lump, and it's like, I didn't realize it was a double.
Yeah, it's...
And this is on narrow Santa Cruz single track, and he just boots it over the section. I'm like, how would I have ever thought that those two things were connected?
You know? One check.
No, I'll take it. So it's just that difficulty of seeing that, I think, is hard. It's a difficult thing for...
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, when you can't... You know, like, the bikes that you build for yourself, the stuff that I build for myself, I know its intended use, and it's, you know, like... you know, with yours, you pretty much, you get to design it for you, because that's where it ends.
And where I'm riding.
And where you're riding, exactly, because that's where it ends. You know, for me, it's like I try and design it for what I want, but then I send it out for testing because I don't know who else is going to use it.
Right.
But it's still within that kind of circle of use. You know what I mean? Like, that's the great thing about, like, our
design. It's a cross-country bike. It's not a World Cup downhill bike.
Exactly. We don't have to dilute what we're doing to make it work for everybody.
Sure.
And that's the beautiful thing. You know, it's like, I think that's one of the reasons I feel like I'm so lucky to work with the guys that I've worked with, is that it's like they, I know exactly what they're going to be doing with it, so there's no like surprises in store, you know what I mean? It's like, when you're doing mass marketing, you have no idea how the shit's going to be used. Like, even when you do all the standard ASTM testing, people are going to fucking break shit, because they just don't give a shit. Whereas the stuff that we're building, like, your stuff is meant to be ridden hard.
You,
absolutely.
You
no two ways about it.
Right. Appreciate you coming.
You know, I don't...
But the thing is, it's
hold
like...
Hold on, let me...
Okay.
You know, but with, like, the Firefly stuff, with the Rita stuff, with Merlin, with all the other... with the companies that I'm working with, you know, we're building heirlooms.
Yeah.
Shit that isn't going to get abused. It'll get ridden hard, but it's not going to be abused.
Right. My bikes are unobtainable.
Right.
They cost me a ton of money to make, and all the time, and everything like that. And then the first thing I go do is I crash it and dent tubes or break it, because that's the game I'm playing. But most people that are buying a bike in the $10,000 range are not trying to go out there and crash.
Exactly. Well, I mean, definitely not people that are having custom stuff built.
Right.
Because they're like, you know, because they know, like, Firefly, you have to wait 2 fucking years. You know,
is
like,
that how long their lead time is?
I think the last time I checked, it was like 26 months or something.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are booked out.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be a little less, but I mean, I think with the move and with the Fork project, that's their timeline is not going down.
Oh, that's right, because they had the move. Yeah. That new location is so good for them.
Oh, it looks so good.
Oh.
It's so good for Tyler. He lives like walking distance.
No, but the thing is, they're right between, what is it, Linwoods and the Fells.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing.
I mean, they're right in the heart of Boston area riding. It's a cool switch.
It seems like a really neat spot, and they have all those rooms. I just really wish they would turn one of them into an S&M dungeon. But it's neither
just
here
what
nor there.
Boston needs, right?
It really is.
Well, they have a lot of bankers, I guess. But let's say
you know what I'm saying, though. It's like, you know, it's very different, like, design principles. It's like, you know what I mean, it's, you know, you're going to go out and flog your shit to basically see you're testing your limits.
Right.
You know, because you know that if it doesn't work out, at the end of the day, it's about you, and the next one, you want it to be better for you.
Well, my goal is to find out what I need to change for the next one.
Right.
That's really what it's about.
Right.
And that's not what's going on with Firefly, what they're doing. They are trying to craft something very special that buyer is going to love for the rest of their life.
Yeah, they're making heirlooms.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Let's get into like a design tricky thing.
Okay.
What do you find so difficult to design, or nearly impossible? Not on a particular thing, but like from a like aerodynamic shapes or like trellis type systems, or, you know, certain things that are like, they're in the common vocabulary within designing the stuff you do, but every time you go to work on it, you are always struggling and always feeling, damn it, I suck at this.
I don't even fuck with aero, because it's just not part of my world. So that isn't even a consideration.
Right.
Thank God. You know, I mean, that's a whole, like...
Oh, yeah, that's...
You know, I don't have the CFD. I mean, yeah, I could run CFD and whatever in Fusion 360 or something if I wanted to, but, I mean, you know, I don't want to pay SolidWorks for their CFD software.
Honestly, within cycling, I think most of what you hear about aerodynamics is merely marketing, because it's uncheckable.
Well, exactly.
And it's, believe us, it's aero, and it's like, nobody can check, so it doesn't matter.
Well,
it's not even real.
Well, that's the thing. They show you the rendering, they show you it head-on, they show you at 20 degrees, and this is CFD.
They show you some colored images, and it's marketing horseshit. And... the problem with marketing based on weight is people can check.
Right.
Right? But once you go to marketing on aerodynamics, nobody can check.
Well, and it's also not a constant. It's right. One of those things that that changes on every single ride. You're never running the same ride twice in a row that has completely different aerodynamics. You know what I mean? Like the wind's blowing from the east today.
Right.
You know, it's...
And not that aerodynamics is not a factor in cycling. My problem is just the marketing has just exploded around that, and it's 95% pure bullshit.
Well, exactly, because it can be.
Right.
You know, they can do that because, like you said, it's uncheckable.
Right.
It can be as stupid and made up as you want it to be because...
And you just say it's more aero.
Yeah.
There you go.
I mean, the fact when they're saying like 5%, 10%, like, that's shenanigans. So my grandmother's brother, Uncle Bobby, he owned an ink company, and I know this seems completely...
A what company?
Ink. He made ink. Uh-huh. He actually made the blue threads for the dollar bills.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so he was fairly successful. But we got together. He's basically a circuit speaker. People would hire him to come and talk at their factories, stuff like that. And what's funny is, like, we're sitting there before one of his things. He's like, you know something, Josh? Statistics are bullshit. All of them. Every one of them. Like, what? He's like, yeah. He's like, the thing is, the way you make them believable is you just don't make it a round number.
Right.
Like, it's never 10% faster. It's 11.5% faster.
Right.
He's like, that people will believe. They won't want to fact check a fractional thing like that. I was like, are you serious? He's like, I get up there and I make up numbers all the fucking time. Nobody cares. They just want to be made happy.
Right, right.
And so that's like, you know.
I had a joke I said for years when I was a kid. Yeah. I say, 90% of statistics are made up on the spot.
Well, exactly. Yeah, but the thing
I just made the statistic up on the spot.
Right, exactly. And that's the thing, though. You don't say 90%. According to Bobby, you say 87.5%.
Sure.
Because that seems like it's researched.
Right, right. It's researched.
You know, that's his whole thing. And it's just funny because it's like, he went and he gave the speech and he made up, and like literally, like he would look over at me every time he gave up a statistic. I'm like, oh, he's straight up lying.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. Nobody gave a shit. They were just happy at the end of the speech.
They wanted to buy the product.
Exactly.
Thing,
you know, and it's like, that's what all these fucking nonsense claims do, is they validate what you already want.
Right,
you know what I mean? They're not looking like...
At the end of the day, is it the right color? Does it match the rest of my bike? That's most important.
Exactly. They're not looking for new customers. They're looking for customers to re-up their shit.
Right, yeah.
We're such a tribal industry. The bike industry is so fucking tribal.
It is.
Once you settle on Colnago, you're never going to buy a DeRosa.
Sure.
Hard stop. You know what I mean? It's like, that's just the way that works.
Right.
And, you know, so they can say, like, Colnago wants you to buy another Colnago. That's why this one's 5% more aerodynamic.
Right, right.
That's all that shit is. It's not about getting different customers. It's about getting the same customer back in the system.
Right. Because you can get them for life. Let's switch back into the nitty gritty here. What design package do you use? What's your design environment?
I use SolidWorks. Or I use SolidWorks 2019. I haven't like upgraded recently because honestly, I don't see why.
They're making new buttons.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
And then I use HSM Works, so I have to have a license for Fusion 360 as well. And I do mess around with Fusion a little bit, but I just, you know, I have 14 years of SolidWorks in me, so I can't give up the platform.
It's like suddenly learning to speak Cantonese in my mind. Whenever I'm put in front of a Fusion 360, but I've never had to. Like, what do you find is good about Fusion 360 compared to SolidWorks?
Nothing. That's not true. Some of the surfacing tools are better, and I actually really like how they do chamfer tools. Like, you can group a bunch of chamfers together as one unit, and they don't break like SolidWorks does.
Uh-huh.
Like,
So it's more integral on those types of features.
It feels like those are... I don't know what the...
About filleting. Does it fill
yeah,
it well?
Yeah, it actually does nicely.
Better than SolidWorks?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Surprisingly
better than SolidWorks.
Right. Because that's always been a big... It's always a big issue. I mean, especially now that we're in 3D print land.
Well, and the funny thing is, now that we're in 3D print land, I've actually started to try and, like, make my peace with SolidWorks variable fillets. I fucking hated them. I would never use them before, just because the results were so unpredictable.
Yeah.
But for doing 3D printed parts, sometimes when you need shit to blend, you got to do a multi-radius fillet.
Yeah.
And it's... I don't like it, but I do it. You know, it'll get you there.
My thing is, and I don't know how Fusion 360 is, but I want to do sub-D surface modeling, because that's obviously where we got to get to. And it's like SolidWorks has dropped the ball completely, and the only way you're getting sub-D is to use the online, what is it, SolidWorks Experience package, and you can't use it standalone and all that, and I don't even know the quality of it. But the thing is, we got to get to a sub-D environment for the 3D print stuff, and it's like, if you look at my models for
prints... It depends if you're building hollow or solids and letting them be shelled outside or doing the shelling yourself.
Right.
You don't really have to get the sub-D if you're just doing surface models. I mean,
I know you don't have to, but I'm looking to try to... Like, you've seen my work in terms of the models that I'm producing for that.
Yeah.
And it's like, I feel like it's... I don't want to go to NURBS. I want to be sub-D, and I want them to be parametric. And that might sound crazy, but it's like, if I'm going to switch from solids methodology, a parametric solids methodology, to a surfacing methodology, there's things I want when I make that conversion, and I want it to be sub-D, and I want it to be parametric. And it's like...
It's a big ask.
But is it? It's like, somebody's been around for what, 5-6 years? And it's like, it's the way it's got to go.
That's true. I mean, I guess that, you know, I was going to say something about like, you know, does it really matter for what we've been doing if we've been using packs long enough? But yeah, evolve or die.
Right.
I mean, that's
the challenge. We're both old. I'm 53. Yeah. How old are you?
52.
So we're both 50. You're 52, you said?
52.
52. So we're both the same age, basically. And the thing is, one of the big challenges I present to me in my life is trying to continue to change and evolve and grow. And like recently, I've spent 2 years on flat pedals after riding SPDs for 28 or 9 years or whatever it was. And it's like, why did I do that? Not because it's better. Clipless pedals are superior. Period. It's just, I needed to change the fucking game up. I needed to do something different, uncomfortable, that put me in a place where I felt incompetent. But that's important for us to grow.
Yeah.
And we're talking about, like, how do we do things differently? How do we approach a problem differently? And, like, honestly, from a modeling perspective, when I'm the 3D printing thing that I've been doing for the past couple of years, I've learned so much about solid modeling since then. I mean, I was trying to learn a lot of stuff before, but the way I look at problems now and the way I solve them are astronomically different. And it's being able to change like that is the hard thing for us old guys. Some kid in high school is going to flick on a switch and they're there.
Because you know why? And honestly, I think it's because we've had so many successes in how we do things.
Sure.
That we're like, we get used to that trigger response.
We know it's going to work.
Exactly. We know it's going to work, and it feels good when it does.
Right.
You know, and it gets, you know, as we get older, failing gets scarier.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, you know, a kid in high school has no series of successes behind him for his failures to be measured against.
Sure. And they also don't have to forget everything they know so that they can move forward with something different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I mean, you used AutoCAD back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And it's like, anybody that's used AutoCAD knows just once you sat down in front of SolidWorks how that game was freaking over.
Done.
Right? Like, then. And it's like, a kid doesn't have to think back about how hard it was or how they would have done it in AutoCAD, because they're never going to use a stupid Boolean architect program, you know? And it's like, it's just, I'm jealous of young people. Like, just from a bicycle point of view, they start out with beautiful, functional enduro bikes.
Yeah.
My first mountain bike sucked, and it was a fat chance. You know?
Wow. You know? I'm sure Chris would like to have some words with you.
Well, no, at the time, it was a nice bike. But the thing is, when we look at what we know about bikes now, it had shitty tires, it had shitty brakes, it had shitty geometry, it was beautifully painted, and the welds were immaculate. But the thing is, it's like, compared to anything today, it was garbage.
Yeah, 100%.
And it's like, these kids now today, I'm jealous of them. I wish I could start on a bike that really worked instead of that. But at the same time, we still had fun.
Well, I mean, but you know, it's like they might. The thing is, you and I can take an old shitty bike like that, though, and go out and ride some buttery smooth trail and have a great time on it, though.
Sure.
Whereas they go and ride that shit and they don't see the point of it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I love flow trails. I love riding a completely rigid single speed on a trail that's just grooving.
Right.
Because it just feeds me. You know what I mean? Right. It just makes me happy. Whereas, like, your big-ass enduro bike, you know, you got to be going up because you need to get back down.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it eliminates one of the more pleasurable parts of riding, which is just nice. Just a good, fun roll.
The mode where the bike is fun is predetermined, yeah. And it's a very particular case that's not most of the ride.
Exactly. You know, right. And it's like, and the ride is now broken up into, like, there's the climb and then there's descent.
Right.
Whereas,
up and down.
Whereas on our cross-country bikes, all the bikes used to ride back in the day, it was just, you're just going out for a ride.
Right.
You know, the down wasn't that much more amazing than the up.
Right.
Which,
right.
You know, yeah, we bitch about because they descended like garbage.
Right.
But we made the most of it and we had a great time.
And people
and
were sick.
Part of the ride.
It was amazing to see, like, the things that are burned in my memory from old full rigid bikes at Mount Snow or something like that, and seeing the crazy shit go down, and just be like, "Holy cow!" And even nowadays, it's still sick. You know,
dude, bikes with 3 inches front and rear winning Mammoth DH.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Because the rider's killing it.
With a fucking 150 stem on it.
Yeah. Right.
Nothing good about this should do that.
Well, that's the miracle of being an incredible athlete.
Yeah,
I mean, they are virtuosos, you know? Okay, let's switch into cam.
Yeah.
What do you said you're using HSM.
Yeah, so I started using HSM Works before it was bought by Autodesk. And I just stuck with it because what I really, like, I've used a bunch of different, like, you know, I've used MasterCam, I've used CamPlete. We did a couple of different cam packages at, when I was at Technocraft. And, what I really love about HSM Works is that it's so tightly bundled in, not bundled, but it's such a well-designed plugin that, like, I change a chamfer and I hit recalculate and I have all my new tool paths.
Sure.
So it is.
That's awesome.
It's parametric cam. I mean, which I know most, I know it's not that exciting now, like a lot of packages have caught up on that.
But it was pretty novel back then.
It was, yeah, a decade ago, it was amazingly novel. But the fact is, it's, the file stays in, like, all that cam data stays inside the SolidWorks file. So yeah, my SolidWorks files get a little fat, but the nice thing is they're transportable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I can let somebody work at the file, and when they give it back to me, it still has a cam data in it.
Right.
Like, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I just have to repost the data or regenerate the toolpaths.
Because you're doing very complex stuff, and you're using 5-axis on your machine that got damaged?
4, but it was primarily 3+1 was most of it. Like,
3+1 with a very high-speed spindle.
Very high-speed spindle.
Right.
30,000 RPM.
Right. Insane stuff.
Yeah.
And so you're writing for that environment. You're doing very complex and immaculate surfacing.
Thank you.
And where did you find that HSM had real limitations when you're working at that level? Because, I mean, even in, I mean, in most CAD environments, I'm sorry, in most CAM environments for the parts being made,
yeah,
the surfacing generally doesn't end up like what you're doing. Unless you're like a real mold-making shop or something like that. And even still, it may not be quite how you're doing it. So you're at the higher end of what that's going to do. And it's going to be plumbing out a lot of code to make, yeah, those parts.
Oh, yeah. Huge files.
And it's like, where do you find that it's like, oh, this is where it gets really fussy? and like, where do you find limits with it?
You know,
or where do you find the challenge? Like, are you able to shape your, like, you know how, like, what's it called when you got your ball end mill and you're leaving the groove, but it leaves a pattern?
Oh, yeah.
What's that called? Well,
there's a bunch of different ways. A bunch of different ways to do it, but it's either you can do the radial or scallop finishing. Or...
There's all kinds of ways when you can break it up into sections and all that stuff. And it's like, are you able to control that exactly how you want to, or do you have to game it to get what you want?
A little column A, a little column B.
Right.
It's pretty good, but, like, the critical thing is, like, setting... like, one of the important things is, like, setting your depths. So, like, making sure it stops before it goes over an edge and you waste a bunch of time cutting air. Like, if you're cutting, like, say you're cutting, like, a domed type of surface, it's like, how far down that dome can you go before you're wasting time, before you lose the quality of the toolpath? And likewise, you know, you have to, you know, it's where you have to trim them back. And for a lot of people, like, in production stuff, they can just pretty much, they do a quick pass and, you know, they do one or two little refinements and then they leave it there. But for what I'm doing, because...
It's got to be like jewelry.
It's got to be like jewelry. So I'm literally picking through every single path and, like, I, you know, I do multiple iterations on those to get them to stop exactly where I want them to.
Is that mostly in the preview, or is it in the machine?
It's all in the simulation.
So the
if it simulates right, I mean, that's a nice... That's what I really like about HSM.
If it simulates right, that's what you're going to see.
It cuts 100%, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And what I love about it is that, like, that's what I love about HSM Works inside of SolidWorks is that it's like I can actually change the model to fit what the tool can do on the fly and then recalculate and have that work.
Right, right.
Which is fucking amazing.
You're updating your model so that you can get better results in the machining. I mean, it's literally designed for machining.
Yeah.
But, like, back and forth design for machine.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what
like
makes
in it, the model.
That's what gets me high. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just like, holy crap, like, I can make this stuff work by, you know, and it's, you know, and a lot of it's a limitation of what tools are available. Cause, like, at 30,000 RPM, you know, your tool, any little imbalance you want to have, you know, it's going to start making a lot of noise. So you want to have the tools as short as possible.
You know what? Hold on a second. We're going to step outside because I think our bill's paid.
Yeah.
And we're. Okay. You were talking about editing those files.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I, you know, it's really, I think that's one of the, what am I trying to say here? One of the great benefits of being, like, end-to-end design to machining is that I have all the tools in front of me. It's how do I put them together? It's like the world's most awesome Lego set.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're in that position. Like, I do a lot of design. I'm in a virtual environment a lot, and I have a manual shop. But the thing is, like, you know, you're doing design. You're doing all the CAM, and then you're doing all the machining, all right there in the same chair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and it's, you know, there are certain benefits to it, but there's also me being as obsessive as I am about surface finishes, you know, because I cannot get past the watchmaking tool set, mindset sometimes, I will sit there and fight over 1/1000th of a fucking inch to get a line to end somewhere right. You know, just to perfect a blend, you know, for something that nobody will ever see. And that's, like, for me, that's one of my major weaknesses is that I can't say when sometimes, you know what I mean? Like, I look at the stuff under a freaking loop after the first one's done, and I was just like, oh, I see all... oh, God. Couldn't have picked another time. I couldn't tell.
Well, we're the same that way. I mean... Like, I've been talking to people recently about, you know, being OCD or being Asperger's or being whatever kind of neurodivergent or whatever thing that we all have a certain amount of in us, and some more than others in certain ways, and the key is, find out how it's your superpower, not your weakness, and leverage that in the world. And when I see people do that, it's incredible. And you do that with your OCD type thing, where you're just focused in on that. I got other friends where they're super successful, and it's like they barely got through high school because they were not functional in that system. Yeah. But you put them in a different system, and they thrive and they take over. And it's, and like with me, you're talking about toolpaths and getting that perfect surface finish. If I don't have the math for something, I'm bugging out. If you looked at the background what's being generated that you don't see in the models, construction geometry, mathematics,
you've shown me
and all
formulas,
that stuff.
Yeah.
And the thing is that if I have some bad math, I'm freaking the fuck out, and it brings everything to a halt for a week while I sit there and work out some crazy 3D CAD trigonometric equation out that then becomes the mathematical solution, and that it stops me. I can't move forward. Everything stops right then. And the thing is, I get to the other side, and it's like, well, it's not as obvious as a finish or what you're trying to do, but the thing is, it's what makes my work.
Right.
And the thing is, what we're doing is different. Because the stuff we see out there, it's like we know what's going into there. I mean, like it's the 80-20 rule, like when I talk about the expertise post, is that 80% or most people are going to do the 20% of work that gets the 80% of the results.
Yeah.
That's rational. That's what smart, normal thinking people would do. It's when you have to go further that you become an expert, that you become that person that knows the deep shit. And the thing is, it's like normal people aren't going to do that because it doesn't make any sense. And you just have to fucking give in to your superpower that makes your work different, better, special, whatever it is. And that's just stuff you got to own. I mean, you named your company OCD.
Actually, Kevin at Firefly came up with that.
Oh, Kevin did.
It was brilliant. But
okay.
I did not hesitate to take it. Yes.
Right, right, sure. You've owned it. Right?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah.
And the thing is, it's like, well, shit, yeah, of course you are. Of course you are. And the thing is, that's why your work looks like it does.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, that's the thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it's you know, the thing is, the industry needs all of these. Like, that's the beautiful thing about the bike industry is that it has room for all of these different things.
Sure.
You know, it's like it has, you know.
We need the artists. We need the mathematicians.
Exactly. You know, and it's just, it's otherwise we just have a bunch of the same boring shit. You know, it's like whether or not, like, you and I aren't going to make any kind of dent in the industry in terms of numbers.
I know I'm not making a dent.
You know, but what we're going to do is we're going to inspire people.
I hope.
That might make a dent in
the industry. That's honestly my hope.
You know, I mean, that's where the difference lies. And, you know, people, like, aren't inspired by Trek. They're like, yeah, this is fucking cool. I spent a bunch of money. End of story.
Right. I mean,
you know,
that's...
Trek doesn't make you want to go out and become an engineer. Like, you get an engineering job at Trek because you love engineering, not because you love Treks.
Right. And I think within cycling, there's that problem of writing a check. Now you own a thing.
Mm-hmm.
That experience sucks in my mind. Like, just cutting a check, you own something. There's so much more to this world. And when I put my material out there, I want some kid to see that they can actually do it. They can affect the world in their way, their thing. And it's not about cutting a check. It's about doing the work or thinking the problem through or putting their twist on it. Shit, if they want to buy a Trek and they sand it down and they give it their own graffiti paint job, I'm fucking stoked. Because it's no longer a purchase.
Danger home that shit all day.
Danger home. Some people hate him. Some people love him.
I love him. He's a crazy person.
I hate the bikes. I love what he does.
I mean, you know.
I love what he does. I just don't like
Scott makes interesting stuff, and they let him do what the fuck he wants with it.
Sure.
That's the amazing part. Like, for a company to have that much self-awareness to be like, no, it's about him, not about us. We get to ride along with him.
I hope
that's really what it is.
I hope he's free like that.
He totally is. I've talked to him about it. Like,
okay,
they pretty much.
Cool.
They
just free reign.
Yeah, he gets to
that's
just
cool.
Go wild. Yeah,
but the thing is, like, what he's doing, I don't understand why I don't see more people doing that. And it's like, what does he do? He polishes up some levers. Sick. That's cool. Wish I saw it more, but I only see it when I'm looking at a danger home bike. Generally,
yeah.
You know, other than someone whose parts they made or whatever. But like, you don't see people like taking their parts off and it's like, oh, they're gonna redo it. I mean, no, you do a little bit, but you don't see it on the kid down the street. You know?
Well, right, because now everybody's afraid of breaking their shit.
They're just afraid. Breaking their shit.
No, I think
it's like,
that's like, a good point. It's not just afraid of break. It's the fear of doing something out of the box.
Right. You did something. You might fail. It's like, yeah, but you might not.
You know, damn it, I grew up in a world where you might not.
See, but now we're getting out of bike industry stuff, yes. And this is just cultural, okay. Like...
Right, right, sure.
You know,
I mean, could talk even more for that.
Like, this will very quickly devolve into me dumping all over social media.
All right, right, sure.
which this is technically for social media, so...
I love social media. I also hate social media. Yeah. I think it's got beautiful things and it's got bad things. Here, let's flip this around. Okay let's look at model-based definitions. Okay.
Okay.
Have you gotten a chance to work with any of those new files of model-based definitions that have tolerances and everything like that within the solid model file yet? I'm looking forward to it.
I have not yet. As a person at the end of the day who's hitting his own tolerances, I haven't had any,
right.
Like, I haven't needed to.
You're never transferring the production documentation.
Exactly. Right. I mean, the only production documentation that I'm transferring is for printing.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's pretty much...
Yeah. You could do a go, no-go on whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah, because that's something I'm really interested in, and I want to learn more about.
It brings a lot more power, but I think that it's for an order... It's for a scale of production that neither of us are ever going to be at.
Well, like... I mean, obviously, I'm a sucker for prints, and you see me posting prints on Instagram. Yeah, like, very few people post prints on Instagram, but the thing is that I've always told people when I'm trying to help them or coach them or teach them about CAD and design and making things is make 2D prints. Make 2D prints is super important because you see things different, and when you're tolerancing it and you realize, wait, that's wrong. I found so many errors making 2D prints that go back and I fix my 3D model. But like with this new protocol for the model-based definitions, because largely because I'm not machining my own parts, I have to send a file. And when I'm we're old enough to remember what a proper print looks like, mm-hmm. That's a release print from a real manufacturer, and it's 4 pages of fucking numbers and stuff like that for a bracket, yeah. You know, and
no, it's like an architectural print.
It's covered in all kinds of stuff. And in the modern era, when I go to somebody to print, they have pushed me to make these prints that are essentially model-based definition. Here's the CAD file, and here are the 3 tolerances I care about.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the only ones I'm drawing, other than maybe the material envelope size, so they know how big it is. And it's a very different way of thinking, and I don't like it. What I would prefer to do is build everything into my file, so it's just all there. And whether they want to refer to it or not, they don't. They can, but they don't want to look at a sheet full of numbers.
No,
they want to see the 3 that matter. And I get it.
It's efficiency. I mean, that's the thing. Like,
but at the same time, without an actual definition of what's being made and its tolerance.
Can you please call 911?
Sure. Hold on a second.
What's going on, buddy?
Just what me.
Hold on.
Yes, and I need.
Okay, so we're in the van, and we were talking with Josh, and this guy Emerson comes up to us. We didn't know his name was Emerson at the time, but he's like, "Can you call 911?" And we're like, "Huh?" You know, we thought at first that he was going to panhandle us, but he's asking for 911. So we're like, "Well, yeah, of course we'll call 911. And he has blood all over his face, and he was talking to some dudes, jumped him and beat on him and tried to stab him and stuff. And so Josh is calling 911, and I'm getting him to sit down and chill. And Josh is answering the questions from 911 and asking him. And yeah, eventually they show up and question him and everything like that. It was a very odd way of being interrupted, and hopefully he's going to be fine. And he's definitely a dude known to the folks at the police station, but he got the help he needed, but it was quite an interruption. So tomorrow morning we're going to go on a bike ride over at the Horse Gulch, and then probably pick back up at Josh's shop after the ride. Anyway, good luck to Everson out there. Hope everything straightens out.
All right, here we are. We're in Josh's shop. We just did a ride with legendary Ron Andrews. We were in Horse Gulch. Had a good ride. Everybody was happy.
Had a great ride.
Had a great ride.
Only one unplanned dismount.
Yeah, only one dismount. But we're in Josh's shop checking out his new machines. And you were just talking about this nice new Kitamura you got here with the dual contact Cat 40 spindle.
Yeah, it's so before I left LA, I picked up a three-axis machine to supplement the four-axis machine, which, you know, rest in peace. I wanted to have a second spindle in case something happened, and I didn't realize how forethinking that would be. Forethinking? the foreshadowing that was.
Right, so, foreshadowing is probably good.
So I've been able to, like, you know, the problem is there's no interchangeable programming, no tool holders, no nothing, so it's like building a new machine from scratch, which, you know, anybody who's built, you know, set up machines knows that takes a lot of time.
Are the widths of the T-slots different on this? Is that what's, a big issue?
Well, the 4X machine doesn't have T-slots.
Uh-huh.
It's all tombstones.
Oh, okay,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's whatever you want it to be.
Sure.
It's, so this
now
one,
you're on T-slots.
Now I'm on T-slots, and fortunately, 5th Axis makes these guys. They have rock lock plates that just drop right onto it.
Sure.
And, it's been great. I'm actually just kind of optimizing where the
work holding's amazing these days, ain't it?
Oh, it's so fucking good. Oh, God.
Yeah.
I mean, this 5th Axis stuff, like, I've been wanting to spend money on it, but the other machine, I would have had to, like, buy a tombstone for it and just all the other setup stuff, whereas, like, you know, that's a nice thing about just having a basic-ass 20 by 40 table is that just bolt the stuff down.
It's a gorgeous table because your Y is awesome on this.
Oh, yeah. X.
No, Y.
Why? Oh, yeah.
Your Y is so deep that it's like you can fit a killer plate on this.
It's 40 by 20 by 20.
Uh-huh.
So it's a gigantic work envelope. And then I just added this Pearson Pro Palette system. So now I don't even have to keep a vise permanently on the table. Like, I always like to have a vise.
Sure.
Just because, you know, basic, you know, immediate, stupid, whatever. But with the Pro Palette system, I can get the vise on and off in no time.
Right.
Like, it literally takes 1 minute and it's pneumatic.
Right.
So, like, I haven't set the air stuff up yet, but basically it's pneumatic ball locks. So you can just basically drop the vise on anytime I want. So it frees up another...
The whole flexibility of CNC milling these days is just so magical.
Well,
I mean, it costs money. There's a real investment, but it's investment in productivity and flexibility.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, and it's just... It's the flexibility. That's where I see the real value, because it's like I don't do long runs of parts.
You're a prototype shop.
So, exactly. You know, I mean, 100 parts is a big run for me. You know, so to be able to swap fixtures in 5 minutes and be running on a new part, you know, I mean, that's the beauty of it, is this, you know, I have programs set up, so I dump all the tools in, it automatically measures them all, and I'm running, and that's it.
Oh, like, it does an auto Z?
Yeah, it does. So I got the
tool. It'll just run the carriage and do them all.
Yeah.
You're drinking your coffee.
Yeah,
it's measuring Z's.
So long as my typical tool load doesn't exceed 1 inch, so I have it set up so that everything, the Touch Pro basically does fine up to about 3/4 inch.
Yeah.
You know, after that you have to start offsetting it to catch the edge of the tool.
Sure.
But it's so, you know, for most of my jobs, I literally just load them up and just say measure X, you know, tool 1 through tool 20, and then I hit start.
Right.
It's amazing. Like, it's such a time saver.
And then, as you said earlier, you have through spindle coolant on this, especially for titanium, you just gotta have that.
For drilling tie, you still can't go fast, but you don't have to stop. Like, the thing is...
You're not gonna melt your tool.
Well, you're not gonna melt your drill. I mean, I don't actually use it so much for end mills and stuff like that. It's really primarily for drilling.
Sure.
But the thing is, like, titanium, where you're destroying your drills is every time you enter the workpiece.
Sure.
So peck drilling is how you normally have to do it on a tool, on a machine without through spindle. This one, you're just constantly...
But that's just to get the cooling done at the end.
Exactly.
And then you're constantly having to break through the surface.
Well, every time you touch the surface, that's when you wear your drill bit. Like, once it's engaged, you're good. Like, an end mill, like, loves to cut. It hates intermittent cuts.
Right.
So what you're doing is when you're peck drilling, you're just intermittent cutting with a drill bit.
And now you're just doing a constant.
Now I'm just constantly just going straight through. Like, for doing my UDH dropouts, it's a 1 1/4 inch thick slug of tie, and it does 5 holes without pecking.
Right.
It literally just each one, just 1, 2, 3. I mean, you know, it takes a few minutes to drill them because it's tie, but it's like, oh, that's it.
It's not magic, but it's solving a lot of the problems,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And,
Yeah, those are cool. We're looking at this piece cut out. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah, so here's actually...
Oh, and this is on a... Is this a Synthase, or is it just that you haven't done that side?
No, it's a Synthase. Uh-huh. It's a 45 degree.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that's the final...
Yeah, they're gorgeous.
They came out really nice.
And whose bikes are these for? Yours or someone else's?
They're, you know, they're going to be a open market product.
Oh, you're going to... Okay, so you're going to sell frame parts.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, not a lot, but you know what I mean? This is just one of those things that, like, I've always been... Like, dropouts have always been, like, a signature thing for me, and I love...
Well, dropouts are one of the places where the game is played.
Well, exactly. You know what I mean? And it's, like, a good dropout. You know, you can put a lot of catalog parts on a frame, but a nice set of dropouts makes it your frame.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
It's, like,
yeah.
You know, so it's...
Like, I mean, that's like we were talking yesterday about working with premier companies like Engine or Firefly or, mm-hmm. or Independent or whatever. Signature companies. They are... A brand, a status symbol, they are a monarch. And when you are in a position where you're trying to broadcast that, you have to be saying it, as they say, when there's no paint on the bike, can you tell whose bike it is?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you do it.
Yeah.
And also it's just, in my mind, quality and design.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you have a specific design in mind? That's why you're in the realm that you are, and you need a quality level that's at your standard, not open, just general people's standard, especially bike industry. Because for good and for bad, and all that stuff, it's all justifiable. You can have very cheap Taiwanese mass market parts that are perfectly good in some aspects, but in the premier class, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's... You know, that's how I wanted to differentiate Jericho. Is like, that was our first thing, was like the chain rings and the dropouts, the two most visible things on a hardtail.
Yeah.
You know, we did like the flourishes, the head tube badges, the rings, that kind of stuff. But like, you know, there was those two things that like really made it our bikes.
Right.
And, you know, and it's really cool. Like, that was at a time when there weren't a lot of guys with custom dropouts and stuff like that. And it's like, I think...
Well, you're talking what year? You're talking very
this
late, early 90, to 90, early 90, zeros.
99, 2000. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's way ahead of most anybody. I mean, I'm trying to think. When did I do Independence? Was like 97 something, 98.
Yeah.
Somewhere like that, and it's like no, 97, I think. And the thing is, it's like, you know, those things were. I mean, nobody was doing that.
Oh yeah. Then. No, it was. Yeah, it was unheard of.
Right. And
well,
now
not unheard of, but
right. Know. But now it's like. I mean, well, actually, when we were at Fat Chance, Fat City did have a special thing.
Yeah.
But that is a whole different era, a whole different time, all that sort of stuff. And Fat City was a certain brand within that. Like, you looked at Merlin and Fat City across a parking lot from each other, basically holding up the entire standard of what the premier class was.
Right, and that's, you know, and I wanted to bring that, like, but, you know, and those guys, you guys were much bigger volume than Jericho was.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, Jericho, like, we were one of the first companies to be, like, below 100 bikes a year to have all this custom shit.
Absolutely. You Which is I mean? Really hard.
Yeah, exactly.
Really
you know
hard.
What I mean? And believe me, it was a fucking, it was a toilet. It was a time toilet. It was a money toilet.
Yeah.
It was, but people fucking loved it. And that
sure.
made it worth it for me.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah,
I mean? Like,
yeah.
that was, like... People really react to this, and that made me feel really good about it.
I told you I bought a used Jericho one time, and I was setting...
You didn't?
Oh, I didn't?
No, what the fuck?
So I bought a Jericho, and I was like, oh, cool, I'm going to get a Jericho, because I saw a deal on Craigslist or something like that. I got it, and I was like, oh, sick, this is perfect. And this is back before I was building my own bikes and shit like that, and I was like, oh, cool, I'll set this up. Setting it up, we go away on a trip, and our garage gets broken into. And my buddy's Independent got stolen, and the Jericho that was half-built got stolen, and it was just gone to time. I never rode it.
Oh,
how's that? I owned a Jericho, never rode it once. Not because I didn't want to, but because it was stolen before I could.
That
was brutal.
That's breaking my heart.
Right, right. So, okay, so here's...
So,
here's the... Is this the dead machine?
This is the dead machine, yeah. And if you look at it, so it fell over onto this side.
Right.
So it fell off the forklift on this side.
That's amazing. Just like, so in case anybody's listening that doesn't know, Josh was having his machines delivered, and while taking them off the rigger's truck, the machine fucking fell off to earth.
Not even fell off the truck. It was literally on that corner of the building. It was 20 feet from the door.
20 feet?
One turn from being in the shop. And the guy just, he picked it up on the forks. I asked him to pick it up differently because he picked it up on the long axis. So the forks are real close.
Right.
And I'm like, hey, dude, it's off camber around the corner. I'm just not good with this. Like, this isn't what your brother and I agreed to when we contracted. And he's like, ah, it'll be fine. Literally 30 seconds later, I'm watching the thing. Not 30 seconds, but I'm watching the thing fall off, and it was like in slow motion. My friend Elijah was here, and we're like looking at each other like we had that moment, like,
oh,
while it was falling.
I can't even imagine. It's probably the most unbelievable thing you could imagine, watching a four-axis mill falling to earth.
My most prized possession.
Yeah, your money shot.
And you can see the side of it. Like, it's just every corner, every bit of the machine.
It just got beat.
It's just, I mean, look at this, dude. Like, in here, like, I didn't even realize this at first, but if you look, the servo, the ball screw is rammed into the servo.
Oh, my God,
look at the bracket. It's the head shifted over. Like, that's how
hard it needs a full rebuild. It's crazy.
Oh, no, it's totaled.
It's totaled,
yeah,
sure.
This is salvage. And fortunately, they're finally paying for it after 7.5 months.
That's just insane.
So, yeah.
It's insane knowing you're hiring a rigger, you have insurance, everything's on the up and up, and the rigger vouched to whose fault it was and everything. Yeah. And
it still took almost over half a year.
And if you're running a business, boy, that's crazy.
So, you know, it's unfortunate because it's like, you get attached to machines.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like weather.
Especially not,
it's
magic perfect. Ones.
It's, yeah. I mean, this thing, like, this machine let me, compared to the three-axis machine I had before, this machine let me expand, like, my skill set and my capabilities and, like, what I can do in a way that it's hard to, like, I got to jump, like, a level.
Right.
Know?
I've had that experience where something takes me to the next level, and it's shocking. And you're attached to it, like, you go, oh, that.
Yeah.
Like, my new bike, the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah.
It's a second bike named Millennium Falcon.
Gorgeous.
It's a cool bike, but the thing is, there was another Millennium Falcon. And that's the bike that I point to where I said, that's when I missed it. That's when the world was giving me a hint as to what to do, and I missed the hint. And I know that that's when it was. And it was like, so we have different moments where the whole world changes. And sometimes it's the moments you miss. And sometimes it's the experiences you have where you grew a pair.
Yeah.
You know, you grow a pair and you're like, I am a man now, or a woman, or whatever. You are on a different level than you were before. You were a kid and now you're an adult.
And that's, yeah, exactly. And that's what this machine let me. I was terrified when I got it. I was like, I don't know how to do any of this. Yeah. Like, you know, like, conceptually I understand it, but like, how do I fixture things now? How do I, you know, like, all this stuff. And it's like, once.
And just getting used to spending that much money on tooling.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Right. I mean that's a whole thing when you're getting into CNC. It's like, I want a CNC machine. I'm hopefully going to have one. But the thing is, just having one, you have to spend a certain amount on tools. And then when you get fancy machines, you're spending $800 for a tool holder.
Oh yeah.
I mean, and it's like,
you spend 50% the cost of the machine on tools to get started.
Right.
Like, that's realistic. If you want to be able to hit the floor running, you buy a $100,000 machine, you're spending $50,000 on tooling.
Right.
Not just end mills, but, you know, fixtures, you know, all that stuff. And
so if you buy a used $6,000 machine,
you're going
to expect to spend $3,000 at least.
Oh, no, I just meant for new machines. Like,
okay.
It's, I mean,
so it's going to be $6,000 on tools if you buy a $6,000 machine.
It's, well, it's still going to be $50,000 in tools.
right. Okay, it's just $50,000.
It depends. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you want to buy tools that match the machine. Like, you can't buy a nice machine
and
cheap tools.
This is a 200 millimeter stem?
I think it's a 160.
160.
That was the second,
that's a 160?
That's the second stem I ever made.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fillet braze, single binder clamp.
Oh, yeah.
Thin 1-inch steer.
Oh, yeah. That was on my old Schwinn Paramount.
Yeah. It's got to be more than 140. I thought 140s.
I just said 160.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're right. I'm dumb. Anyway.
But yeah, it's, I mean, you know, and plus it's like, you know, there's the direct tooling, and then there's all the metrology that you have to do on the end. Because the thing is, the more accurate your machine is, the more accurate your measurement tools have to be. So it's like, every time you go up an order of magnitude in precision, you go up an order of magnitude in price.
Right.
Like, you just can't skip that.
And if you're a job shop and you're working with the clients, like I have a bunch of friends, they have five axis machines and CNC lathes, and they have real shops, like big, like they're there for making parts, like for other people. And it's like, you just got to go to CMM. And it's like, then you're dealing with CMM, and then you're fixturing CMM, and you're dealing with
but
all
the
that.
The thing is, that is like, that's the end of the game. Like CMM is like, that's it. Like once you get a, I mean, I'm terrified to spend that money. Like that's ridiculous.
Well, it's strange because I walked my buddies that work at Joby, and they're doing, electric helicopters, but of course, I'm sure like anything else, they'll be autonomous soon enough. But the thing is that I go into their metrology lab, and oh yeah, they have a couple big CMMs, and then they have little CMMs, and then they have, you know, what is it, like air bore gauge measuring, and you know, there's a wall of machines where it's like, please explain to me what it does, because there's no way in the world I could guess.
Yeah.
And it's measuring something.
Yeah.
Either a surface finish or a flatness thing that is beyond what the CMM can do or whatever.
But the thing is, when you're at that level, when you're aviation aerospace, you build the cost of the measurement equipment into the bid.
Well, I mean, isn't that what anybody's going to do for everything in a way?
Yeah, I mean, again, we're talking bike industry, sure, you know what I mean? Yeah, so it's I mean, my metrology equipment is pretty fucking basic. It's some drop gauges.
Oh, sure. For bicycles, don't need...
Right.
A level of precision that even a machinist would be accustomed to in large parts.
But they should.
Sure. It only makes your job easier. Yeah.
But I just mean like, you know, people accept sloppy ass tolerances. You know what I mean? It's like the funny thing is after making my own watches and doing some production parts for other watch companies, you know, I got used to, you know, thermal controls. I got used to measuring everything. And, you know, we're talking half a thou tolerance. Like, that's what I got used to.
Right.
And then when I started working with the guys at Firefly, they're like, yeah, if we could keep it pretty tight, like a couple of thousandths. And I kind of chuckled. I was talking to Jamie.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, if we can keep it to like a couple of thousandths. I was like, you know, okay.
Right.
And I just realized how fucking arrogant that was.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh my God, that's actually tight as shit for the bike industry.
Well, also, it's like good engineering. It's like if you have loose tolerances, why wouldn't you have loose tolerances?
Well, right. But I mean, that's, you know, like from... You know, doing the automotive stuff, like anything engine related, you're talking again sub, you know, below a thousandth tolerance, you know, any kind of bore stuff like that. So it's like, you know, you get used to this, and then it's like coming back to the bike industry, like, you know,
it's easy for you to hit.
It's an easier, the stress isn't involved. It's a lot less, which is what I love about it. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, there's certain things, you know, like, I mean, that's why we ream and fucking face everything afterwards because, you know, it's like, yeah, leave a little extra material and clean it up after. That's not a thing you do anywhere else.
Right.
Everything has to be dead nuts to start.
Right.
And then, you know.
Well, we were talking earlier today and I was talking about 3D print distortion.
Yeah.
And strategies around that. And, you know, you're using... different domestic higher end suppliers than I am. I'm using offshore and I'm using the cheapest I can find in a way. And I'm dealing with distortion of a certain type. And I'm changing my tooling to account for it rather than fix the distortion in a way. I mean, I prefer less distortion. There's some things I can do, but but still my tooling's just going to get better.
Well, that's so what that I can say. You have the flexibility. Yeah, exactly. Right. Like to accommodate that. I mean, it's like working with castings,
right?
You know what I mean? You have to have, you can't have rigid tooling for castings. You got to have tooling that has some adjustability in it
because
castings, you know, after being annealed or
they change shape.
Exactly. They all get weird, you know, but, you know, I mean, that's what I love about working with Silka is it's like they're real clear about like, hey, this is where it's going to distort. Put some supports in here.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's like it's nice. You know, it's like they don't automatically build that stuff for you, but they tell you where it's going to be.
And of course, you're paying for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
But I also get to design it and get to, you know, maximize the value for that.
Sure.
So it's, you know, but it's nice, you know, it's nice having a company that's literally that phone call or that email away the same day that, you know, you have that rapport with.
You know?
And that's, you know, that's what I love about, you know, it's higher end, it's a higher end cost, but it's like the product.
Like I send an email to China and it's like, whatever it is, 16 hours or 19 hours away.
Yeah.
And it, it's not going to be like that. It's not going to be like, there's not going to be customization. There's not going to be that. It's just like, no, we run it through the system. Boom. The machine people, I'm still learning about
that. Really nice. So.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's like, again, we're talking about what do you need versus what would you like? And I would like better. What do I need? I would say my last run of prints had a shift in them that I could blend a little, and I had enough wall thickness where I could play that game because I've built in some more safety factors and things. So I could blend more and fix a shift. But it's like I'm paying lowest global price. And it's like with that comes, well, here it is, you know, and you're going to have to nudge it a bit. but I kind of like playing the cheap game. You know, I'm not against spending money. Yeah. Or I don't want to spend my money. If I was spending someone else's money and buying the best shit, I would love that. But I'm spending my money, and and it's a hobby, so it's a cheap game. And strategizing and gaming cheap, I find more interesting than spending.
See that? That makes sense.
It's more of a game.
Yeah, I guess this is where we want to spend our time too.
Sure.
It's like for me, it's like I'd rather, you know, spend the time up front and know that I'm going to get the right thing and be able to get that right to the customer. You know what I mean? Like the amount of work that I have to do, like for those post heads that I was showing you, like I'm trying to get my post delivery production time down to like under 20 minutes.
Sure.
Like I just want to be able to clean up some bores and, you know, either blast it or anno it or, you know, whatever the customer wants.
Time is money.
Exactly.
And you shouldn't be spending your time because you have to do other things.
Exactly. But it's like, you know, but I also at the same time, I like doing QC. Like I like making sure that the stuff is perfect, you know.
There's also a lot to learn in that. Like one interesting thing that I have is like, so I design my bikes, I make them, I finish them, I set them up, and then I ride them. A full, holistic experience. And what's interesting is I'll go through setting up the bike, and I'll be taking notes about, this zip ties were a little tight here, or I need to move something over a bit, or this doesn't line up right. I'll take all those notes. So then when I go to that back to the design time for the next bike, I go through those notes and I fix all those things. I do that each iteration. And I'm constantly going through this whole process, or I'll be on a ride. And I'll be on a ride. It's like, you know what? I don't like how that thing is doing this. I'm going to, like I was talking to you earlier about my seat stay yoke and how it gives me leg clearance and stuff. That's something you would only know if you were riding the bike and you had fat legs and you had a particular style that utilized that space on the bike. And that informed the design of my bike. But I feel like a lot of bike designers don't ride, or they ride, but let's put some quotes around it. And they certainly don't put the bike together. Like years ago, I was trying to help some friends put together some Ibis Mojo HD whatevers or something like that. And I was like, my God, there's no way to cable this bike properly. and you wouldn't know that unless you were the peon that had to put the bike together. Right. And it's like, I'm just sitting there going, they did not think this out at all. And they didn't QC to find that there was a problem. Or their molds were cut and that was going to be it for the next 3 years as they amortized them. But the thing is, it's like when you're putting it together and you go, oh, I need to change the cable locations on the next bike, cable stop locations, and you do, and then you're constantly refining on that level. That's the nice thing about, oh yeah, you design them, but when you're doing QC, you're kind of looking at it with different eyes.
Yeah.
Sort of like, yeah, we draw in 3D, but the thing is making 2D prints, you see it with different eyes. And all of these steps informs the designer and changes how you think about each decision you make.
Yeah. Yes. And I think that that's what you and I are in such special positions that it's like we're in control of the process from concept to delivered part.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It's like
our customers are just different.
Yeah. Well, yeah, your customer is you.
Right.
And my customer is, you know, me in a way, because I, you know, fucking, if you don't like it, don't fucking buy it. I don't care. I'm not making something for you.
Right.
I mean, I hate to say it like that, but it's like that at the end of the day, that I want to ride.
You're the standard bearer.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like I'm making shit that I would ride, and I'm a very pretentious person. Like,
sure.
You know, I want the dopest stuff.
Right.
So that's what I make. But like what's nice is it's like, you know, when, you know, you're talking about like, to put it back in the shop, like, you know, what you're talking about is like when you're riding and you're, you know, like this little thing bugs you. It's like, I got the same thing. Like when I'm watching a program run, like if I see sloppy tool paths, I'll go back. And like, that's the beauty of like having such a a limber system.
Sure.
Is that like, I'll go back while the part's running, repost the program, and the next part I'll save maybe 10 or 20 seconds or get a better toolpath. So it's like from the first part to the fifth part, it's going to be a fairly different part for a new part. And it'll probably be running much faster, but it's like there's a certain joy that I take in just having a beautiful program.
Sure. Oh, dude.
You know,
and it's if I was doing my CAM and writing programs and running them at the machine, I would be doing the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not to the same meticulous level, but like if I saw some fucked up, the typical CAM thing where it does this cut and rapids home and then rapids down to almost the same position and does another cut. I see that and I want to scream. That kind of motion, I just lose my fucking shit.
To be fair, that specific thing that you just described sometimes can be almost impossible to get rid of because
it still makes me want to fucking scream.
Oh yeah, but here's the thing: like, I'm not going to go in and manually edit that out afterwards.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like when it does. Well, the thing is now, the funny thing is, like, the Z travel on these machines is so fucking fast.
Yeah.
It's 2,000 inches a minute in Z. So it's like, zip, zip, zip. You know, like, it's already back in the cut
before I think,
you
can, like, I think it would still drive me nuts.
It does sometimes.
Because I believe, like, in the concept, like, you're talking elegant code, an elegant program. That's,
but here's the thing,
your pride and work.
Elegant code went out the fucking door with CAM systems.
Oh, sure.
Elegant code is handwritten code.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, CAM code.
Because honestly, we both. How's this? Did you learn to write code at the machine?
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. How many people really do that in the modern era?
Every single Jericho part was hand-coded.
Yeah.
Did it take me way too fucking long?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Did I destroy hundreds of dollars of end mills? No, I destroyed thousands of dollars of end mills.
Right.
Same thing with parts. Same thing with pissing off customers. But at the end of the day, I mean, I didn't do a good job training myself on the job with that.
Sure, sure.
But what I learned is invaluable today because, you know, now it's like the value that I place in, like, the efficiency of my of my design to machine time is, I mean, yeah.
I think if you talk to a real computer programmer, they're going to say the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, because a real computer program is going to look at some of the shit that's coming out of people now and just be like, what the fuck, are you crazy? What, are you drag and dropping the whole fucking world? You know?
Well, I mean, you know, like CAM, it just, even if you have a really great post-processor that, you know, it knows
every YEM code everything.
Well, I mean, they all do that.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But it's like, if you have one that basically is set up to, like, you know, linearize everything that needs to be linearized and, like, keep everything that needs to be a curve, like, sometimes it linearizes every, like, it turns these little fucking arcs into 1,000 little straight moves. And it's like, what the what? And the crazy thing
and
is...
And it was a G2 or a G3.
Exactly. Yeah. But the crazy thing is you can't see it.
Right.
So it's like, you know, like all the...
Yeah, you don't know unless you're looking at the code.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it doesn't spit out. Like when you're doing 3-axis surfacing or 4-axis surfacing, primarily that's all straight lines.
Right.
But it's little thousands of an inch moves. Sure. So it's like, it's way too small to see, but it's like, you look at it and it's like, oh my God, there's 500,000 lines of G1s right here.
How's this? From your perspective, because you're living in that world, when you see straight lines versus G0s or G3s,
yeah,
other than lots of lines of code, what effects do you see at the tooltip?
Nothing.
So it's imperceptible as a final product and as a cut, but you're just seeing tons of code go through. And your machine processing speed's capable of handling it?
Yeah, all the new machines, it's 10,000 blocks a second.
Right, because I've been around older, cheap machines that if you started throwing them lines like that, they just start stuttering or something.
Exactly. No, I mean, the new controllers are bananas, but it's just... You know, I have the beauty in the design, I have the beauty in the tooling, and I have this fucking pile of code.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's just, it's funny because it's like, it's just, it's a weird, like, middle step that just is ugly.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I would love to have CAM software that, like, spits out beautiful code. But that's the thing, I work with FANUC stuff. You know what I mean? I work with all, you know, standard G&M codes. I don't do hide in hand, I don't do any of that stuff, which is amazing. It's like, what you can do on the machine with that stuff is great. But now you're talking about machines that start at 500 grand and go up from there.
Right.
And that's not my...
The Austin Roach machines.
Exactly. Yeah. You know what I mean?
His CAM now, I can't remember what package he's running, but it's some insane CAM that can do the crazy shit that he's doing.
Yeah.
Because it's so nuts. It's like, no, you can't use HSM.
Right.
On his machines. Because, well, why do you have that machine if you're not going to take advantage of it?
Exactly.
And HSM can't take advantage of what those machines can do. So he has to run these crazy CAM programs just that would dwarf, you know, it's probably the cost of these machines or whatever to run the cam.
Yeah, no, some of the stuff, it's, I'm of course blanking all the names, but it's like, you know, that's what I love about SolidWorks. Like, I don't do, like, I run 2019.
Right.
I don't do maintenance. I don't do anything, you know.
It's like a lot of things. It's a developed enough program where it's like, if you know how to run Adobe Illustrator, it's not any different. Yeah, there's different magic wands now, but the thing is, how the program functions and how you get the work done has not changed.
Well, exactly. There's like that threshold that it's like on 3 and 4 axis machines, doing that, going to like that crazy next level doesn't get you anything. You can spend all that extra money, but it's like, for what, you know?
Right.
Like sometimes, like, I love nice tools, but CAM software, like...
Right. If it's just a 3-axis machine, most CAM can do that.
Exactly. I mean, even 3+2 is, believe it or not, Fusion 360 HSM works. It does 3+2 surprisingly well.
Right.
You know, which is like, you know, it's not.
But if you're doing spindle handoffs.
Well, yeah, that's a whole different. Right. But that, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, if you're doing multi, like lays with like multi chuckers and all that kind of stuff, that's a whole different thing. That's not even my world.
Right, right.
You know, I love that stuff, but I just nothing, I couldn't. None of what I want to
make. You couldn't make that pay for itself in any way.
Well, it's not that. It's that none of what I want to make needs that. You know what I mean? I don't need that tool because that's not the parts I want to make.
That's true.
You know, I mean, what a double chucker lathe, a basic double chucker lathe, yeah, that'd be cool as shit, but that's now
You're just throwing money at something.
Yeah, right. But I mean, if I wanted to start really doing lathe parts, I would definitely get a double chucker. Because, you know, I mean, that way you can do a hub in one setup.
Right, right. It's one and done.
Right. And the beauty of it is, for the most part, you can hand code the basic cycles, and then you basically just use the CAM to do all your surface finishes.
Sure.
You know, that's not possible with multi axes machines.
Sure.
I had a point I was leading towards, and I totally just lost it, so...
Yeah, it's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine. We're talking about stuff.
Yeah.
How about this? Let's take a look. You have some of your 3D print parts floating around?
Yeah,
let's take a look at that. So yeah, by the way, we didn't say earlier, but Josh opened his door, and I'll take a picture. Outside his door, you'll get to look at the San Juan Mountains and get inspired by them, and it's pretty awesome. Not a lot of machine shops get a view that is destination trail access and gorgeous. Fucking beautiful.
And I made it my goal for the summer, because Yeti used to be right there at Four Corners Welding.
I used to work at Handlebar.
Okay.
Right.
You in that case, I need to help you pick your brain. I want to find the Yeti lunch ride.
Oh geez, I never went on a Yeti lunch ride.
Well,
I rode with people from Yeti, but I didn't go on a lunch ride.
Okay, so there's a deep road right here.
Yeah, I can see, because I would like, so this is an industrial lot or an industrial park in Durango at the edge of town. And right at the back side of it, there's like an open space, undeveloped area.
Yeah.
And Yeti moved here from LA, and they were here for a while, and then Schwinn bought them, and Schwinn did it for a few years with their homegrowns and then shut it down. But while they were here for a while, it was Mert Lowell was there, and Frank the Welder was here, and a lot of the Yeti stuff was happening here. And I worked down the hill at Handlebar Motorcycles, and now Josh is at the top of the hill with these, what could be the Yeti lunch ride behind it. You know,
it's
what?
Definitely.
You got to talk to Frank the Welder. I bet he knows.
You know, I bet Frank knows. And I also bet Ron Andrews knows.
Ron would probably know too.
And you know, it's funny. Ron told me, I didn't realize Barracuda was in the same building.
Oh, Barracuda.
Barracuda was diagonally. They were in number 104.
So check this. Ed Zink bought the Barracuda shit and they warehoused the tubing behind Handlebar Bicycles.
I love it.
And I went in there one time before I left because the shit was just getting, no one was buying it because Barracudas really sucked. And they were like, what Surly is to making bikes, where you use 2 to 3 millimeter wall thicknesses, that was a Barracuda.
Yeah.
And the thing is, anyway, I took a whole bunch of bottom brackets and brazons and some tubes before I left. And it was just funny because there were piles of tubes, which I honestly wish I could have access to now, because there were some neat ovalized tubes there.
Yeah,
you know?
they were.
But they were thick as shit. I mean, these things were like, you could make a billy club out of it.
Well, that's dirt jumpers.
Yeah, I mean, you can make dirt jumpers would be stoked to have those tubes.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, the view, like when I came to look at the shop, the owner that I was buying it from. So I own my condo spot here. This is my workshop. I own it outright, which is fucking amazing. Yeah. It's such a great feeling to have.
It's yours.
It is fucking, this is my sanctuary right here. But when I came in to look at it, the guy had this back door up. So we walk in the front door and we walk into the workshop and the back doors are open. And I saw that and I was like, ugh, I'll take it. I am so it was just that moment of like, you got to be kidding me. This is a life that I can.
You got to tell me if one of these places opens up next to you. Maybe I'll give me an excuse to not be in Salida.
I'm just buying anything that opens
up. You're just buying it all?
I told the realtor, I'm like, next thing that opens up, because he has the whole complex. Yeah. I'm like, I want the next one that opens up. I got first dibs.
Oh, just give me a shout. Yeah. Let me know.
Okay. Yeah.
Because you know I'm preparing to make changes, and this could tip the scale. Because it's dope. It's dope as hell.
And the thing is, the view is amazing, and it's a northern view, so we just get such nice like breezes through the shop.
Right.
And
by the way, we're going through the shop. There's Jericho and Ogle frames everywhere. Well, he's got all his frame museum here.
It's actually Ogle number one and Jericho number one.
Okay, so Ogle and Jericho number one.
The first frame I ever built, and that's the first Jericho I ever.
And of course, the first frame you ever built is a Horst Link amp rear end Ogle.
Yeah.
You know, probably circa like I'm going to say 90 or 89. I don't know which.
I'm flattered. 92.
92.
Yeah.
But when did he come out with that rear end?
Around then.
Yeah.
I was one of the first ones.
Funny when you look at that main pivot. it's a tragedy to call it a main pivot.
What you just didn't say in the microphone is that it's a lugged front triangle with an amp rear end.
Sure. Yes, it is.
That's the ridiculous part.
Right. It's crazy. And here we are. Got Godzilla's pinball machine. Okay. Let's look at some prints.
So here's
Cool. Okay, so plastic now.
Yeah, so this is so I don't actually have any of the metal prints here because they it's just all customer stuff.
So these are plastic mock-ups.
Yeah, so this is like, you know, as I was going along with the Firefly stuff. You know, I just wanted to, you know, just having to iterate as I go along.
Right.
And you know, because that way it's like, you know, the nice thing is it's like, yeah, it's not functional, but
sure.
You know, so I initially had a Formlabs printer, and it was so expensive to freaking run. Like, those Formlabs are ridiculously expensive. Uh-huh. You know, the resin is like $250 a liter.
I think if you're in the real world of making stuff, cheap, quick plastic is what you want. Because by the time you're ready for anything that looks halfway decent, just get some fucking prints made.
Well, exactly. You know, and that's like, and that's why I basically use it just for like mass evaluation.
Right, right.
Like, how does it look? Does this actually design?
Does it fit?
Does this design work? You know?
Right.
And you can't tell that on the screen. You know what I mean? The screen looks great,
difficult.
But you have no... it's not just that it's difficult, but like, you know, me, also that.
You're going that direction?
I'm making that bike.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I told you my 3D prints were going to be fucking bananas.
You were telling me about this. It's so not me, bro. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Seriously?
Oh, yeah.
And is it mainly an aesthetic choice, or is there an engineering 100%. Reason? Is it all aesthetic?
Yeah. I mean, so there's enough glue.
You know what it is? It's the fucking Nautilus, bro.
That works.
Just call it the Nautilus and be done with it. Because that's what that looks like.
I mean, it's a little bit of Batman. It's a little bit of Art Deco.
I just call it the Nautilus with those ridge backs.
Yeah. Shh. Don't give any details.
Okay. So I asked. I always ask, what can't I take pictures of?
You can't.
Josh said, you don't have to worry about anything. And then it's like, oops, surprise.
Well, this is screen stuff. I just met stuff that's actually
been made. I don't know. Anyway, it's gonna be a shocker, folks.
Oh yeah, no, that is meant to like that bike is like, because the thing is,
you're throwing it down.
Yeah, it's like so much 3D printing is. People put a little bit of character into it. People are still scared to like make it fucking wild, which you can do now.
And if you're a guy like me, I'm not trying to make it wild in any way, but mine do look different than other people's.
Right.
But more from an engineering point of view, but you're trying to do a style here.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing for a road bike, you know, you can put that character into it that would be wasted on a mountain bike.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's
and like, it would be,
there's a certain level of disposability to mountain bikes.
No, but also it's like your design time. But the thing is, there's no real added expense downstream.
Right.
So it's like, oh yeah, go nuts. Throw 4 more hours into design. And then it's built in, one, it built into your model infrastructure. But then two, it doesn't cost you anymore.
Yeah.
A print's a print.
Yeah.
And just do it right in the design part, or do wild in the design time. And the thing is, then you can make 10 of them. And it didn't cost you any extra?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, 10 would be great, but to have, like, that's what I love about printing is that you can do fucking one.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, once you have, like, I mean, so you do, you establish your baseline print, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, you have to do a bunch of prints to get to the one perfect one.
Sure.
But then that's the beauty of the system now is that you can iterate frame sizes and geometries on individual frames.
Yes, so you can, you can
print that crazy lug set for any geometry.
Yes, I think
within reason on a road.
I think that's what I mean with 10 prints because,
oh, okay.
As we both know from a design point of view, there is a huge cost to just going wild on every iteration, or like you don't just do it totally different for a different customer
right.
without paying that cost. But it's like if you're just changing angles or how it fits within
right.
a tube or something like that, yes, it is truly a different part, but you didn't go through and change your entire model.
Right.
And you that, set it up well enough so that it can absorb those kinds of changes. You're not spending another, I mean, in my world, if I was going to do another yoke set, I'd be doing another 70 to 150 hours of CAD time.
Right.
I'm slow and that's how it works. But the thing is, that's a huge cost. But if it's just changing an angle, that's not. I might fix a few broken fillets or something. Right,
but you and I are both like obsessive about building models that rebuild correctly at all the different.
Oh, right, right. If, like, well, but if you're not doing that, you suck. Who wants a guy that makes breaking models?
Well, to be fair, most people don't do models that have to be multiple sizes. Like, that's something that is very unique to the cycling industry.
Maybe that's what a problem I'm informed by, is that when I think of modeling, I think of flexible and durable models.
Yeah, that's not a thing.
But also I listen to a lot of podcasts where they're talking with design engineers and mechanical engineers, and model durability is a huge talking point.
It's a big thing, but to be fair, they're not like, you know,
they're not changing it as radically for
exactly.
a model.
Exactly. It's like if they rebuild it, they're rebuilding it for new design constraint. They're not
oh yeah,
might,
dude.
Yeah, that might be a 3D printed crank.
well, yeah, of course. Well,
and ignore those dropouts. I started the design a long time ago.
Yeah, those aren't up to snuff at all.
No, that's a through axle. Come on, I mean it's quick release. Right.
Wait, what? I saw one of those in a museum.
No, that's I started working on this design, that crazy lug set.
Uh-huh.
I was going to machine that.
Okay, now that's expensive.
Well, not when you have the machine.
No, I think it's still expensive. You're going to be doing
it. Yeah, wow. Because the surfacing on that, I got up to it and it was basically 35 hours for the lug set.
Right.
Just for the surfacing.
Well, remember, what is it? Chris King did those Celio lug sets.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were machined.
Yeah.
They look gorgeous. Yeah, but the thing is, it's like,
didn't make a penny on them.
I can't imagine any money was made on those. I could only lose money. But it was gorgeous, and maybe he just had to get that one done.
Sometimes that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's, but yeah. But yeah, 3D printing stuff.
Okay. And are you doing flat mount 160 there?
So this one's a 140,
uh-huh.
But there's also a design for 160. And this is...
See, this is my issue. That should be connected.
I know.
Like that, it's hanging out there that could be structure that adds to the dropout.
Yeah, I mean, even just a web in there.
Yeah.
But to be fair, this is just, this was the first pass. This isn't that just connecting the dots. This is a few stages after that.
Sure.
But it's not a finished part.
Yeah, I know. This is your pile of dead soldiers I have a pile like that.
Yeah, I mean, these are just...
Where it's like, no, don't look at that. That one's garbage. I get it.
Well, totally, you know, they're all just different proof of concepts. It's like, you know, each time you look at it, and that's why it has a caliper on it. So it's like, okay, where do we actually have space to improve it? You know what I mean? Right. Like mounting the caliper, you know, until you actually put the parts on, it's all just jerking yourself off.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, okay, now I can see like, okay, we need the... Yeah. So,
right.
You know, that's why I like to print the stuff and at least do like a partial assembly. And, you know, and that's like with the Firefly Fork stuff, it's, you know.
Is this the fork one?
That is, that's an earlier version of it. Yeah.
Right. That's right. Cause you had these proud afterwards. There we go.
Yeah.
So let's see a different one generation to another.
Well, no, that's actually, that's very similar. I think what we changed on these guys was,
at the back. Oh no.
Oh, you know what it is? It's, no, it wasn't that. It was, Oh, I think we're changing the spacing. We're moving this. We're playing around a little bit with the caliper spacing.
Yeah.
But yeah, what these didn't have, like if you look how like there's like that cutout there, right. Which just bothers the shit out of me.
Oh yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah. So
I deal with the same problem all the time.
Yeah. And so I actually added a wet end for production that they really didn't want.
But is it something they can just grind off if they choose?
No. I told them this has to be here for strength. Like, uh-huh. I basically didn't give them the option on it. Sorry, I'm opening a CAD file. All road. Yeah, so...
You know, my naming scheme is date first.
Yeah.
Because you can instantly organize it according to which was done last.
So I added those. Uh-huh. So that way it softens that radius and right. Gives you like a nice, yeah. So I made sure that was thick.
But you got to clear your rotor.
Well, it's going to clear the rotor, but also I made sure that flange was thick enough so that we'd be printed hollow.
Okay. So you know what we just talked about? Hollow. You got to do that on the rear. That see that? That's the rear too.
The rear, like I said, the rear is just, it's a work in progress.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's, I thought about some different ways to do that, but it's like, yeah, those two.
I really like that rotor cleave out of there. It's, I mean, we know it's there for a mechanical clearance reason, but because of how the fork looks and the fork is very streamlined everywhere, and then to have essentially a facet produced.
Yeah.
I think is nice. Well, or at least I've gotten that impression looking at the images, you know, that were posted and everything like that. I was like, I kind of like that facet. But again, I don't see the rotor. The rotor's not in there yet. And it would be nice to see when it's all together in front of me in real space and everything like that.
I mean, I can show you the assembly that has everything together.
No, it would just be, you know how it is when real life and everything like that.
Well, no, and that's the thing. Like I went back and forth on this one a bunch of times. You know what I mean? Like there was different curvatures. There was different...
right.
You know, and it's like, so this is the...
Clearance cuts are a very interesting art.
Well, you know, exactly.
Because it's what it absolutely has to have. And then there's... What should you do?
Yeah.
And it's not the same.
No. Well, and that's, you know, that's one of the things I love about this. Like, here's the other side. Where is it? Road, all road. Is that missing? All road drive tip. Here's...
I would love to read an article about CAD file naming nomenclature. Because it's a nightmare. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at them, what we wanted to do was like make sure that we had spoke clearance.
Of course.
So that's the first cut.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So we went back and forth.
And the next one's rotor cut.
Exactly. So we did all the stuff. And it's like, you know, on the first one, that was like.
My yokes have similar things where I have the crank cut.
Yeah.
Then I have the bottom bracket tool cut. Exactly. And then I have the crank arm. Well, there's the crank arm and then there's the chain ring clearance. So yeah, I mean, my yokes have several different cutouts for all different parts that have, and some are radially cut and some or rotationally cut, I should say.
Yes.
And and others are straight line cuts.
Yeah.
Because they have different reasons for being cut.
Yeah. How much clearance do you actually need for these things?
Right.
Yeah, and for this one it's like I wanted the top of the cut. You know, that was sort of that was just a design consideration. But, you know, it generally follows the line of the rotor.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's just, it was, you know, it got to be like, it was too many. I mean, you can see it's not a gigantic build tree.
Right.
But, you know, for what it is, it's...
Like, I think if I was designing that, given my thing, and granted, you have probably a tenth the construction geometry I would have, and I'd have a bunch of equations built. Do you have an equations field?
Nope.
Yeah, zero equations.
Not one.
I would have equations, but I would say, I bet you my feature tree would be at least three times bigger, including the construction geometry.
Yeah.
And that's different methodologies. I mean, neither of these, one isn't right or wrong if you're getting the results correct. But the thing is, it's like, this is how I do it and how I prefer to work.
Well, right. But also, I mean, you're talking about, you know, you're... Construction geometry is for a whole frame. You know what I mean?
I pass down all kinds of things. Yeah.
Right. And this is a much, you know, for a fork, there's much less, you have, your constraints are much more.
But how's this? Just for the brake mount.
Yeah.
I would have probably eight planes and at least four axes generated for that.
Huh.
Right. Just for the mounting of the caliper.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm. I just have an angle.
Right. I've found that creating very durable and flexible models, it comes down to that. And so I build that into my architecture. Now, early on, I might not have that in my sketch mode where we were talking about the ideation part of the process. I won't have a lot of construction geometry at that point, just some basics. But as I get further and further along, I'll add more construction geometry. And that really, in my mind, makes the model more durable and more mathematically defined also. Because again, that's one of the things that drives me crazy is I want the math. I want the numbers type of thing.
Yeah, and I get that. But again, you're talking about something that has, you know, frame has so much more variability. This is a static structure. This is a fork. Once it's done, it's done.
I know, but it's a dropout. I mean, I have dropouts. You should see the planes on my dropouts.
Right, but you know? The thing is, you're connecting multiple different things. This goes to a straight line. This is,
yes.
And that's it. That's the
yes.
end of it.
Yes.
Like, we're not going to be iterating this.
Right. I'm just going to... this is just different stuff.
No, I know.
And it's like you've gotten beautiful results.
Yeah, I looked at this like when I was starting it. It's like, yeah, this is basically a static thing. We're going to do three offsets. We're going to do three fork models, and that's it. You know what I mean? The time that it would have spent to like set up all the other stuff is money I wouldn't have gotten back.
Right.
You know, I can't tell them like, hey, so I spent 35 hours building this beautiful master
model. Well, that's the thing.
That we're never going to change.
Right. That's the thing. I'm going to masturbate for like 40 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
Like to me, it's just masturbating.
Yeah. To me, this is a job. This is something that like, you know, I needed to get paid for, and I needed them to have something that was financially,
totally
good. You know what I mean?
Well, like
charge them.
I told you my buddy Ronan, he's that engineering in Silicon Valley. And it's like, he's in the move fast and break things world. And it's like, our models, like how's this? Your models look far more familiar to me of mine than his, because he's moving so fast and it's just speed. Fast, fast, fast. Awesome results. They do crazy things, but he's always just like, is it faster?
Right. Everything's a fresh start.
Everything's fast, because if he gets it done a day earlier, that's what they care about. And these companies will spend $10,000 to speed something up one day.
Right.
That's how important one day is. And it's like, it changes the mode. It changes how methodologies and how you work and what world you like to work in.
It's making your work disposable.
It is in a way, but I think there's a different place when you're early. If you're trying to be first to market, if you're trying to be fastest, get there, get the IP, get it now, and get it done because you've got a keystone point or a waypoint for your investors,
right,
where you have to pass a metric by a certain time. And it's more important than anything that you pass that. Because otherwise you won't get second round funding or whatever, then that changes things. And it doesn't mean, I think, that your modeling is disposable. What it means is 3 years from now, when you're doing infrastructure build out and production documentation for the line of the S-class, whatever, that's when it gets all dialed in.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing. It's like,
But that's what I mean by disposable, is that work, you're going to end up duplicating that work later.
All my work is duplicated constantly.
No, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about like what you're talking about with your friend Ronan, is that it's like, you know, it's the slam it out the door, get it done, and then you end up having to completely rebuild that.
But like I've said, it's like in my world, just with my bikes, and I'm doing all that build out and everything like that because it turns me on and everything like that. But the thing is, it's like, I will rebuild it entirely the next time I hit that model. Like from Wendy's bike to my bike, I rebuilt all my models. And I did the same thing before that. And before that, but I'm trying to do, it's trying to be works, R&D level stuff that I'm trying to like totally change all this stuff. And I guess to me, I don't look at a model as ever being like, okay, this is done. It's like, no, it's going to be completely rebuilt again. Every time we touch it, we're going to rebuild it again because we're learning and figuring out a whole new way. And this part here might be in production for 2 years.
Right.
Right. And it's like, that's fine. Right. And it's, I mean, that's the thing that's so crazy about modeling, and especially in the 3D environment, is we all have these different modes that we're working in, and a different strategy in one strategy in one case is great and totally wrong in another.
Yeah.
And we're all working in these different ways, and lots of those ways, from what I've heard, haven't been defined in the discussion, where we can talk about, like, if I took a CAD class, I'd love to take a CAD class where someone who knew what they were talking about, which is almost impossible to find, but like would talk about, oh, here's five different strategies for modeling, depending on different environments that you're in, that are effective and meaningful and economical, right?
Right.
And discuss those, because I think modeling is one of those things where there's very creative elements involved. How you create, what your intentions are, what you're trying to do in it all. And your way might be great in your world, and my way might be great in our world, and we just can't even translate them. And yeah. It's a weird thing like that.
Well, it's funny because it's like we're both building bicycle parts, but we're doing them so differently that it's like, you know, it's like you said, you're looking at a whole weapon system. Like that's your whole thing.
Right,
like
right.
You're designing everything from front to back to work together to play nice.
Right.
And I'm, you know, hyper-focusing in on individual components.
Right.
Like, the stuff that I'm doing with
but Firefly, you're not,
like we're doing it piecemeal.
But you're different. There are plenty of people that do some component stuff that you see on Instagram or whatever. They're in the marketplace. They do components, or someone does frames. But like you are a particular person that makes frame parts. You make frames and you make components. And like your breadth is like in there. Like, and I have that breadth too. You're working with, you know, a lot better equipment and doing some pretty fantastic stuff. But like we're both making bikes, making frame parts.
Right.
And making components that mount on them.
Right.
And not a lot of people do that.
No.
Or even at big companies that do all that with their companies, like specialized.
Yeah, the people in the different departments don't talk to each other.
They never talk to each other. The person that makes water bottles never does anything but water bottles.
Right.
Right. And that's a whole different type of thing in those worlds. So, yeah, that's why it's so, I'm trying to record a lot of this discussion. It's going to be a long recording. But the thing is like, it's how often do you hear this discussion?
Not that often.
Right. Yeah. Especially if you're, you know, hopefully someone's listening to this that's just getting started and they're like, oh, that's what these guys talk about. Because how else would you know?
Fucking nerds.
You got to be a nerd. You got to own being a nerd love being a nerd. Yeah.
No, I mean,
you got to love it. Be a gamer. That's what I call it. I have research professors that I support at work, and it's summer break right now.
Right.
And the thing is, when we have breaks like spring break or winter break or summer break, you don't see a lot of people in the hallways.
Right.
The people you see in the hallways are the gamers.
Yeah.
They're the real deal. They're the ones that they do research. They're in labs. And I call us gamers. Because we're playing the game. And a lot of people show the game. A lot of people like to pretend the game. But it's like when you're in that environment, it's like how's this? If I drove by here next Wednesday at 11:30 at night and I hear a machine running and lights are on, that's because you're gaming.
Gotcha. Yeah.
You know, you're in the game. You're playing the game. And the thing is, it's like, I think for people that are just getting involved in this stuff, it's like you have to want to play the game.
Oh, yeah.
Because just checking the punching the clock that is not going to work.
Get you nowhere in this industry.
No. And I think more and more in the outside world, it's true as well. Nobody's like, how's this? The guys in Silicon Valley that I know, all the ones that are doing well, that are hired and everything like that and surviving and getting moving on to the next job, they're awesome at what they do. They're awesome at what they do because they fucking own it and they love the game. And there's very few jobs out there that are going to pay well in the modern world that don't involve you fucking being for realsies. Showing up halfway means you're in the unemployment line nowadays. in my mind.
No, I, you know, well, at our level, you know what I mean?
No, but so, I think even the average level, I think we're going to see an apocalypse of jobs, and it's all going to be those people that feel fine checking, punching the clock. And all the people that are left are the gamers.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, now we're starting to talk about this whole AI apocalypse that's coming. You know,
I'm not even talking AI apocalypse. I'm talking just like in farming. Okay, me and my wife on a road trip, and we just drive by all these farms. And when you think of the turn of the century, from the 1800s to the 1900s, the amount of work it took to till the soil by humans and beast was unimaginable.
Oh.
And the workforce involved in creating food supplies was unimaginable. And nowadays, one person takes care of 100 acres.
Yeah.
And soon, that'll be automated, right? And the thing is, everything else is going that way. And this isn't AI. This is just the robotization. Well, you and I have been in the machining trade. And the thing
industrial,
is,
yeah.
Robotization and CNC machines put a lot of menial, not very intelligent, not very capable people out of work. And those jobs got moved to China or Brazil or Mexico. And the thing is that even then, the automation took away the jobs. And
well, I guess that's what I should have said instead of AI. Is that
sure.
Like, you know, AI is taking away all these, you know, all the basic copywriting jobs, that kind of crap.
Sure.
I mean, it's people just whatever.
Because it was garbage in the first place.
Well, exactly.
Right.
But yeah, it's what one man in a shop can do now. I mean, I think this goes back to like Alex Pong, like in the early 90s, like Magic Motorcycle.
Oh, okay.
One dude in his garage,
right?
You know, made all these amazing cranks and shit like that.
Right.
And it was,
but how many did he make?
Doesn't matter.
Oh, it doesn't matter. It revolutionized everything.
It was the level that he did it.
Sure, sure.
It's one.
He
guy.
Changed the whole game.
Exactly.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. Like, it wasn't that he made 100,000 of them. It's that he made something that
nobody had ever seen before.
Exactly. And he did it in a way that people are like, how?
Right.
How is this done? You know?
Right.
And it's like, yeah, it's one brilliant dude with one fucking CNC machine knocked the whole industry on his ear. Like, Cannondale's like, we want all of that.
Right, right.
You know? I mean, that's, you know, that's, he showed that that was doable. You know what I mean? Like when I was just coming up and I was looking at his stuff, you know, I was just like,
it was the dream.
It was amazing. I was just like, I couldn't even fathom that shit.
Oh dude, it was,
you know,
made me drool.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And then,
but like, I mean, here's another thing. And I broached on this yesterday off mic, and I talked with Brad Bingham about it, is the rise of the competition.
Mm-hmm.
And that the change in the layout, you know, we got to where we are because we started in real shops as Groms or whatever, and rose up and stayed with it and all that stuff. And then now we are where we are. But the thing is, lots of people nowadays, they have Fusion 360 on their computer or even at school, and they send off and get some prints. And before you know it, they're showing a bike that competes directly with what we're doing. I mean, I know that you're on a very high level, but the thing is, it's changing so rapidly that new faces are coming out of nowhere at a very high level. They are smart.
Mm-hmm.
They're observant.
Mm-hmm.
They're paying attention, and they're using the tools at their disposal, which is exactly what we're doing. I mean, you have that machine, but I don't have that machine, and I'm capable of doing some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
And the thing is that they're doing that now too. And it's like, now we have all these people all over the world suddenly competing in this space in a way they never could before, because you really had to have the infrastructure before.
That's true.
Nowadays, you don't. And the thing is, I'm seeing it. I see someone just on any given day, someone, boom, on Instagram. It's like, who is this? Where the fuck did they come from? Oh my God, what they're doing is really good. And that's almost a constant now. And we have an industry that's built on old names, a lot of them doing the same old thing, but also a lot of really creative people doing creative stuff that have been around for a long time, but someone can just pop up out of nowhere and instantly compete with them. And I think it's awesome. I think it's terrifying, because at 53, I'm becoming irrelevant very rapidly. And I see a 25-year-old that's capable of doing that going, oh my God, they're going to work circles around me. They've got more new ideas. They can ride better. They're not held down by the baggage of the past. And I mean, that's what's coming at you. It's coming at me.
I'm not sure how to respond to that. You know what I mean? Because I feel like you don't, the tools eliminate some of the work, but you still have to put in the work.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It's like a lot of the stuff that I see coming out, it's like, it's decent, but it's derivative.
There's derivative work,
you know,
but there's in there is some real shit.
Oh yeah. Well, it's like, it's people trying to find their flavor. Trying to find their...
Like, derivative work is a constant. Derivative work is the easiest garbage to make.
Yeah.
Because all you're doing is copying somebody's shit. But, you know, we were listening to a Malcolm Gladwell thing yesterday, and they were talking about appropriation of things. And this is, I think, in an interview with Rick Rubin, and about appropriation. Yeah, and it's like...
So great.
But the thing is, it's like, oh, yeah, totally insane interview. But, like, appropriation is love. Right? Where you love what they're doing. You appropriate it. But the thing is, when you do that, you blend it into what you're doing. Otherwise, it's a copy. It's not an appropriation. Well, the thing is, it's like when you do that, you change it and you make it yours. And in that process, new things get discovered out of it and create a path. And while we may see derivative content, but we can see some appropriated stuff. But these people aren't dumb. That's why they're able to work at that. And if they're paying attention and they're seeing this change in what it does different, and then suddenly they're on a whole different stream than we are. And 3 years later, we just look around and go, oh, wait, we just totally missed it. Because we didn't appropriate our work. We made our work.
Right.
They appropriate our work. Realized the problem with it, realized the new potential, went off on a different path. We're busy thinking we know what we're doing. And then suddenly we find out we're the fools.
Yeah, but
that's constant.
Everybody has to go through that. I mean, that's part of the process.
It's true. It's just.
I think you're giving too much credit to, like, there are some brilliant young kids out there and the new tools are amazing. But to have, like, a real rock star of a fucking designer come up is still fucking rare. It still takes all of those things and a fucking vision that a lot of these kids are just like, look, I'm making cool shit.
Right. I think,
but they don't have that goal like that. You know,
there's
that
wisdom involved. There's experience and meaning and vision. Like you're saying, yes, sometimes they're missing that. Sometimes they're just doing the cool new trick.
Right.
And I get that. And that is around. But I feel like things are accelerating at such a rapid pace that the time we think it takes to develop what we think is necessary is shortening.
Oh, absolutely.
And, that kid that does his first bike in 2023 or first frame part in 2023 – by the end of 2024, he's totally on track, or she's totally on track. And it could be a 2-year process now.
Yeah, but the thing is, we get to do that too.
But it's hard. It's harder for us. It's easier for them.
I don't think it is.
Huh.
I really don't think it is. The amount of new shit that I've designed in the last couple of years.
And
to be fair, this part of this, I don't want to make this like a recovery thing, but it's like, you know, before I moved to LA, cleaned up my life, you know, I was smoking weed and I just wasn't that fast. Like, I was coming up with cool shit, but it took for fucking ever to get stuff out.
Sure.
And then I was cataloging.
Drinking out, just PSA, drinking alcohol, doing drugs is a fucking total waste of time. Period. Well,
and it dulls your, it dulls your intellect.
It makes you less. Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the point of that is, like, I was looking at my CAD system. I was going through, like, organizing some CAD files, and it's like, holy shit, I've done more design in the last 18 months than I did in the previous 7 years.
I'm the same way.
And yet you're not giving yourself credit. You're saying these other kids are so much faster than you. think about like...
No, because the thing is, I mean, sure. I feel like I know my own tricks. You know, I feel like I know what I'm falling back on and right. what is truly a sea change or a change in the system. And the thing is, yes, as I've matured, as I've gotten to where I am right. now, I've gotten much, much better at what I do. And I've been much, much better at learning to recognize what needs to happen or patterns or say, oh, I see what's going on now and change things. But I feel like this is me taking advantage of current technologies that I didn't have access to before. And because I don't think I'm very smart on these fronts, it's just that I've been hammering away at it for so long, I've finally gotten to a certain level. But what happens is I'm still held back by old thinking. And with the young people, the good ones that do show up are very rapidly going to 3D print and going to getting access to a CNC machine at whatever school they might go to or whatever. And they're smarter. These are smart kids. I grew up, I was the fuck up. I was the failure. And hard work and making up for bad decisions and bad moves early on got to where I am. But these other kids aren't encumbered by that.
Right, but we had smart kids. Like, we were both screwballs. But there were the smart kids that fucking got the amazing jobs and did all this other shit while we were sitting on the fucking sidelines. The thing is, we got off the fucking bench later than they did.
Right, right.
That's the difference. You know what I mean? There's always been kids that are smarter than us.
Smarter earlier.
Yeah.
You catch up, but you caught up at the wrong time, and that's the problem.
Right, but I mean, it's like, you know, so it's like you're comparing yourself to, you know, I guess
I'm just feeling age. I'm feeling old. How's this? We were riding trail today.
Yeah.
Fucking, I mean, I ride uphill so much slower, and in the past year, I'm going so much slower downhill. And I'm having to rest on downhills.
Yeah.
And it's like 10 years ago, I would be charging and I would be taking rests, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it's like feeling the age. And that's physical.
Yeah.
There's also mental stuff. You were talking about you couldn't remember something old. Well, these kids can remember everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Also, I just had bronchitis. I have no oxygen in my
brain.
So, yeah.
I'm just saying, on my best day, I'm not functioning as good as I did 10 years ago. Or certainly not as good as I did 20 years ago, although it took me all this work to get where I am. The smart kids, the good kids that have these access, they're getting there early, and they're going to be doing it during the time they're fastest and leanest and meanest.
Right, and that's the thing. It's like the tools have changed.
Right.
You know what I mean? And the, like, you know, like when we were kids, like...
I got access to an engine lathe, and it was like, oh my God.
Right. But even going to like the technology stuff, like I had Commodore 64.
Right.
I was getting, I learned to program on it and it was the whole thing. Now kids are, you know, like programming, like it's at such a higher level at this point. Like what you can build, like the programming, like the tool sets that you have are so different. Like it took me like a fucking week to make like a little snake game.
Right, right.
You know, writing out every single line of code, peaks and pokes and all that shit.
Yeah.
You know, now it's like, oh yeah, like the tools have changed.
But think of how much, there's two things. How much time you had to waste because of that.
Yeah.
But like we mentioned earlier about the CNC code.
Right.
Is that, well, you understand things on a different level because of it. You know what the elegance should be.
It's navigating without GPS.
Right. Right, it's navigating without GPS. And there's value to that, and there's things you learn. But, yeah, I don't know. I just, you know, I can oftentimes sound negative about the young people and this generation and all that. I get off my lawn a bit from time to time.
No, but
I also see that there are people out there chomping at the bit that are going to take me down.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that.
But that's not new.
I know it's not new, but it's me. It's me.
Yeah.
And it's like I put a lot of hard work into getting where I feel I am, and somebody's going to take me out. And it might not be this year or next year, but it might be the year after.
Yeah.
And I'm suddenly totally fucking irrelevant.
That's getting old, dude.
I know. It sucks.
The thing is, like, you can't, but that's not where you have to put your fucking time. You have to put your time into, like, I get that.
We do. We're both working on stuff.
We're both older than more people. We're both older than there's more, we're older than more people than we're younger than.
Right.
We're at that point in life.
Right.
Half, more than half of the world is younger than us.
And most people never make it this far working with what we do.
Yeah, but you get what I'm saying, though. It's like, we're in a weird spot now.
Yeah.
Like, this is fucking middle-aged man shit.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's like, fuck, I'm not as fast as I was. It's like, so you have to be fucking crafty. You have to do shit that they can't.
That's true.
You have to tie your fucking skills together in a way that these people can't.
Being a crafty motherfucker does pay off.
Yeah.
And you know, that is, like, there's tricks and just the...
The thing is, we know people like they don't. They're great at design, but we know how the design's going to work.
Sure, sure.
Like, we know, like, how people react to design.
Right. I can see people that... They're like, I look at their renders or something like that. And I'm like, oh my God, your renders are amazing. Like that, I wish I could do that. It's like, I probably could. I just have to sit there for 2-3 weeks and learn it. But the thing is,
I'll show you some tricks in Fusion. That's ridiculous.
While I was doing that, I could have been working on something I think is productive.
Right.
And we do have to make choices.
Well, yeah. Are you going to make pretty pictures or are you going to make pretty parts?
I want to make real shit that I ride.
Yeah.
Right. Or real shit that helps me build better bikes.
Yeah, I used to spend a lot of time doing fucking rendering. For who?
Right.
Like, I'm the only person that I'm impressing with. I mean, people are impressed with the rendering, but the fact is when I can drop this in their hand and say,
right,
pay me.
Right, right.
That's a whole different story.
It's true. You know? But I also put a lot of time and effort into those prints you see on Instagram right. or whatever.
But that's not rendering. That's a different...
It's not rendering, and the thing is,
also, like I said... Why is your logo block so big? You have such a gigantic logo on them now.
Oh, on the BikeCad ones?
Yeah.
Okay, there's
oh,
a reason.
Oh, is that just BikeCad?
Yeah, it's just on BikeCad.
Okay.
And there's a reason. In BikeCad, I'm using a 1-to-1 aspect ratio now because of Instagram. Because
right.
Instagram drives engagement not like nothing else.
Yeah.
And so I have to go to 1-to-1. And when you go to a 1-to-1 aspect ratio for a print, well, when it's a full bike print, like it is from coming out of BikeCad, well, that takes up half the image.
Right.
Well, the other part of it is tables of parts or configuration stuff. And there's this whole negative space. What do you do with that negative space? And it's like, well, make a big logo. Because the 1-to-1 aspect ratio sucks balls.
Oh, it's the worst.
It's the worst fucking thing. But the thing is, I can be an old man and yell at the moon, or I can just fucking figure out how we make 1-to-1 aspect ratio prints of bikes, and that's what I'm doing.
Okay.
But the logo is because otherwise there's a huge negative space there.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know what the layout was. I looked at one. I'm like,
oh yeah,
that seems weirdly inefficient.
No, but if you look at my 11x17s or my 10x8.5x11s,
yeah, well, that's
they're not like that. And also, those are generated
from your other prints that I've seen.
And those are generated out of SolidWorks versus BikeCad.
Right.
And the thing is, when I'm talking to the frame building world, it's cool to look at BikeCad. I mean, sorry, SolidWorks images because I'm modeling fully in 3D, just like you are. And using real CAD, because a lot of bike people aren't, it shows them this is what it looks like when you're doing the real 3D CAD stuff. But the thing is, I'm not a hater on 2D CAD or BikeCAD. I think BikeCAD is an incredible program, and I use it all the time. But I've been trying to figure out, and Brent has been very good at listening to me, about making changes that have to do with how we display some things. A lot of dimensions that he's added over the years at my request, which has been cool.
That's really cool.
A lot of changes, like how long did I yell at him about getting vector logos into the program and stuff like that. But the thing is, it's like over time, and we're starting to see the results of that. And when I put that image up on Instagram, if you look at the information contained in that 1-to-1 aspect ratio,
There's a lot. Yeah.
A lot of very important stuff, and there's not a lot of meaningless crap that a lot of other people put in there. And the thing is, if you sat down to study it, you'd be like, oh my God, this is a huge amount of information here. And it's in an aspect ratio that you've never worked in a print before. And I'm communicating it to the audience on Instagram.
Right. And that's why, like, I saw all that stuff and then the giant logo in the corner. And I was just like, God, he can commit so much more data if the logo wasn't that
bad. I know. And you know I'm not a branding guy.
No, I know. And that's what
made I want a data plate.
That's why I had to fucking ask. I was just like, what happened, dude?
I know.
It's so like self-like serving.
This is the thing. As the tabular information grows, there will be less space for the logo.
Good.
You know? But I'm trying to... How's this? This is my challenge because one problem I have, and you probably have too, is... Okay, I want to appropriate. I think appropriation's cool. I want to appropriate rad shit. I will steal, copy, and appropriate anything that moves me forward or makes my shit better. Happy to do it. No shame. And I'll tell them, hey, Joe, I just stole your thing. Sorry. You know, or I mean, in real life, I'd be like, dude, I'm going to copy your thing. I think it's great. Sorry.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever. But the thing is, it's like, I'm ruthless. I'm going to fucking do it. And the thing is, it's like, when it comes to communicating bikes or understanding geometry, I don't have anybody to refer to.
Right. Because what you're doing.
I don't have anybody to refer to. I don't have anybody where I can copy them unless someone somewhere does some detail and I go, why the hell did they do that? And I go down the rabbit hole and it's like, oh, they did that for this reason. But that's not the right reason. It's for this reason. And that's why I'm going to do it, right? But that happens very infrequently. But the thing is, it's like, I'd love to be some kid learning bike design and look at a PVD print and go, oh my God, I'm going to copy that. I don't understand it, but I'm going to copy it because obviously it's something's going on. And in that process, I would learn more than ever before. But the thing is, who are you copying? Who are you appropriating? When you look at somebody else's work, who is it or whatever, or how often does that happen where you go, oh yeah, I'm totally copying that. Or I'm totally going to integrate that into my design.
Asking me this question directly?
Yeah. You don't have to name names, but you could say that it happened recently or it doesn't happen often because you are obviously doing what you do at a very different level.
You know, it's an amalgam of 30 years in the bike industry. You know what I mean? I have a fucking catalog of shit, of pictures that I've been saving for 30 fucking years of just chamfers that I like and fucking like pocket designs that I like. It's just little things. And honestly, that's
a thing. But I'm talking whole new stuff. Like, yes, we all have our back catalog, but stuff where you go, you're on Instagram and you go, son of a bitch.
You know, it hasn't been a lot lately, you know?
Because I don't understand why I don't... How's this? I see so many pictures of bikes on the line or whatever where I go, wow, how come they don't get it? They don't know to copy your work. They don't know to copy my work.
Yeah.
They're sitting there acting like the dildo that works in the bike shop that told them about geometry was right.
Think about the fucking hubris it takes to even do what we do.
Right. And then when hubris is of a young man.
Exactly.
Is absolutely the worst hubris of all.
The worst in the world. And, you know, we both made it through that somehow.
Right. We've still got hubris, but we know how dangerous it can be.
Well, exactly. But we also have a sense of self-preservation. So it's a trade-off.
Right. But the thing is, it's like that pride thing is motherfucker.
Yeah. And, you know... Nobody could tell me how to do it when I was young.
Right.
And I made so many people did not like me when I was a young kid in the industry.
Right.
Like, cause I thought I knew everything. You couldn't tell me what was right. And I talked way too much shit for what I could actually produce.
Right. Or as we like to say, you're a young man.
Yeah. I was a man in my 20s making shit.
Yeah.
And,
but the difference is
God bless kids that can come in with some humility and learn.
But
that's who I'm scared of.
My worry with the humility ones is that they lack a voice. I think the overly humble, thank you, humble ones end up actually lacking a voice. And in general, I think the humble people are the most derivative.
Interesting.
I think it's the ones that are dangerous. The ones that have sharp fangs, they can get themselves hurt or they could end up hurting all the rest of us. And like you said just a second ago, we survived the hubris of being young. And it's like, I guess I want to see a way to keep the hubris, to keep the balls it takes to go and make your own thing, but with the ability to actually learn and listen to people that actually know what they're talking about, or recognize that the jerk off that's closest to them is in fact an idiot. And somebody else might know a lot, will actually know a lot more, and maybe just pick up the phone and call them. Because there are people that know more, and the thing is, to waste 10 years of your life listening to people that don't know what they're talking about is an awfully terrible waste of your 20s or your 30s. Like, how's this? I was working for Chris Chance when I was 20 years old. You know? I was trying to learn as much as I possibly could at that time from essentially one of the top authority figures of the time.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot. And a lot of people in that world, the Fat City world was a special ecosystem at the time. I can't say how self-hurting my hubris was at the time, because I certainly was a proud young man, right? Full of shit. But I was trying to learn. I was trying to figure it out. And I was right next to the person that should know the most of anybody.
Right.
And certainly I will say today that almost nothing in what I do with bicycles is informed by what I learned then. There's a couple things about connecting a tube this way or how you might want to weld something over here. But in terms of understanding bicycles, nothing. And the thing is, most of the information that's out there today that's commonly referred to, especially by the young people, is just as bad as the information I was exposed to back then. And I'm here to say all that shit is bullshit and wrong.
Okay.
And I want to see that 20-year-old fucking read my blog, throw away the garbage, because let's say there's half of it's garbage. But if half of the shit I've said is garbage, that leaves a huge amount of material that's for real and informed, even if you just throw away half.
Well, and I feel like a lot of like the knowledge in the bike industry has been changing. It's slow, but it's just, you know, cause it's, I mean, knee over pedal axle. Thank fucking God that shit's dying.
It's just crazy.
It's dumb. It made sense back in the day when people, I mean, it didn't, no, that's bullshit. It didn't even make sense back in the day.
Bontrager,
but
at the time proved that it was wrong.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? It's like one of those things that just, it becomes, we have such better data now. You know what I mean? Like that was a thing that like kind of made sense at the time.
But the language of cycling and cycling technology is the language of the 14-year-old that works at a bike shop. And that kid reads magazines. And people that write for magazines know far less than anybody else in the bike industry.
At least some of the blogs, that's for sure.
Oh, God. Yeah. I was thinking formal magazines. You start reading the blogs and it's just...
Oh, it's a disaster.
Especially that PVD guy.
But no, I mean, like, the whatever. I'm not going to shit talk any of these sites.
Right.
God, I'd love to, though, because they're so bad. You know the ones I'm talking
about. Oh, yeah. No, I just... The shill. It's just... If you do anything, learn the word shill and attach it to wherever it falls in line, and you will start realizing that 90% of the media you're consuming is entirely shill.
And it's a lot of it is regurgitated press releases, you know, like
no, it's guys. Look at Pink Bike. It's actually just press releases.
But at least they don't try and couch you to something else.
No, they do that too.
Do they? Ugh, that's
what do you think press camp is?
I don't know.
We're going to fly you to Italy. Have a good vacation. I hope you write a good article about us. And if you can't write, here's some copy for you.
The, This is true.
How about this? What remember the scalded monkey?
Vaguely.
Okay.
What was that?
That was the Santa Cruz blur.
Right.
How does it climb? Like a scalded monkey.
Gotcha.
Every article you read referred to it climbing like a scalded monkey.
Yeah.
You know why? That's what was in the press kit.
Well, yeah, and thinking back when we were doing Jericho and we were doing a lot of advertising, they basically said, "What do you want us to write?"
Right.
You know, they basically said, you know, and then they would modify it a little bit. But yeah, they basically said, you know, "What do you want us to hit?" And it's like, oh, okay, that's what our advertising dollars are getting us.
You know, when I was at Fat City, and this is going back to 1990 or so.
Can we take a break for a second? My head is fucking pounding me. I just want to pause.
Okay. Cool, cool. Here we go.
Sorry.
Uh-huh. Okay, we're back. I was just going to say we're talking about all the marketing and the hype and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
When I was at Fat City, there was this thing, and this, I don't know how much fact is associated with this, but this is what people were talking about, was that Mountain Bike Action was the big magazine at the time.
Oh, yeah. It's huge.
And Trek had released a mountain bike, and Mountain Bike Action did a review of it and basically called it the worst bike you could ever buy, and that the bike was total garbage and blah, blah, blah. And Trek pulled their advertising for a year. And you never saw another bad article written about a Trek.
Yeah.
It's amazing how money talks.
Yeah.
And that is how it works. And I think people don't quite realize that that's how it works. That you very rarely read honest opinions or anything saying bad product. There's buzzwords that they use that are, in a way,
dog whistles for this is a bad bike. Yeah.
Like, this could be really great on just the right trail. That means this bike sucks on all trails.
Yeah.
Right? And stuff like that. But the thing is that it's really a sham. And there's just, they're in the marketing division. And anybody that leaves a magazine goes to work for the marketing department.
Well, I think that's, well, yeah, I mean, fucking, like Ferrantino ending up at Santa Cruz.
Right. What a happy accident.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, who would have guessed?
Who would have guessed?
Right. And, I mean, and God, what's his name God from Pink? From, yeah. Was it Bike or Pink Bike? What's his name that went to, he's now at Canyon?
Yeah, exactly.
Nice enough guy. I mean, whatever. But, you know, yeah, they just move on to who was paying the money in the first place.
Well, right. But to have, I mean, but it's a brilliant way to like have that connection to the, it's a brilliant, yeah. Anyway, but like, I mean, that's what I love about Escape Collective. You know about this? So
which it was, is that the new one that they got formed out of the ashes of cycling tips?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's like James Wong and a few other people. I know James personally. So I,
right. Right.
Dude, he's vicious about some of his reviews. It's amazing. It makes me so fucking happy.
I like James.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily like what he writes.
Really? If he doesn't like it, he doesn't mince words. He doesn't say works on some trails. He's like, this thing is fucking crap.
Huh. Maybe I have to look closer.
Fucking, but yeah.
Right, right. Right. Maybe I have to look closer, but I mean, we do need more of that. But at the end of the day, maybe that's what's going to get him. That might get him through the primaries.
Do you follow him on Instagram?
Yeah.
Dude, read his stories and stuff like that. He doesn't mince words.
Hmm.
If he doesn't like it, he's going to say that. It's kind of awesome.
I'll try to look for that more now.
Like, it's funny because, like, he thought my cages were ridiculous. He's like, this is
your cages are ridiculous.
They are ridiculous, but he fucking called me to say that.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
And I mean, they're ridiculous in the Magic Motorcycle ridiculous.
Right. I mean, thank you.
Yeah.
Great company to be compared to.
Oh, come on. I mean, duh. We're looking at a design he was showing us a second ago. And it's like, yeah, it's magic. It's magic motorcycle on steroids.
It's preposterous.
It is preposterous.
That's the point.
And the cage is worth more than most college kids' first car. You know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
But that's the thing. I mean, you know, again, as having made it to old men, we get to do this shit.
Well, right.
You know, like, this is something that I don't think this is, like, you know, you're talking about losing our edge. Bullshit. Right there is me calling bullshit on that.
I'll give you that. The thing is,
the balls it takes to fucking even think that this is doable.
Well, my critique there would be that
the customers that buy that product can't ride a bike. They don't know how to ride a bike. They suck ass and they're dweebs, you know?
Guess what? I don't give a shit.
I understand. But what I'm saying,
part, you know?
I understand. It doesn't change what that is.
Right.
I'm just talking about what the ecosystem that that goes into type of thing. You were talking about heirlooms with Firefly earlier, and that's great. That's totally a great thing and everything like that. But the thing is, the dentist that rides that bike isn't doing what I particularly value.
Right, but that doesn't mean he isn't enjoying the shit out of it.
He could totally be enjoying. I'm not saying he doesn't enjoy
the value of it based on.
I'm just coming from a more
pragmatic.
Does this because I also come from a very different perspective where I started at Pat City Cycles, where the bikes we were making were more expensive than anybody had ever heard of at the time and everything like that. And the thing is, well, I've been around that type of stuff. My idea of cycling is cheap, works, survives long enough at the price point that it's worth the rent you're paying so that by the time you're buying again, the new version's out and you're getting the upgrade and you're paying the cheapest maintenance cost.
Right.
That's really a lot of my perspective. So this doesn't agree with my perspective. And what I'm thinking of is a kid getting to the World Cup riding on that? And the answer is no, in the sense that it's beautiful. It's light. It's an impressive feat. But a 16-year-old isn't racing enduro on it because they're just trying to get to the next event.
But is a 16-year-old racing enduro on your stuff?
No, but they could. I provide plans online that they could build a frame fixture out of MDF in their high school shop, and they could produce a bike using the geometry I prescribe, and they could be making a World Cup level works bike for themselves for very little money and do that stuff. I don't sell stuff. But the thing is, I'm pushing information.
Right.
In that sense. And the thing is, it's like, I mean, none of this is wrong. Like, and keeping your edge, it's like, the thing is, it's like, there's always a market. We could name several names in the bike industry that continue to make shit the same way they did 40 years ago. Yeah. And it wasn't even particularly great then. But the thing is that they will have a supply of customers until they die.
Right.
And
that's our discussion about tribalism.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And we can find a place in there that is rad and everything like that. But when you're talking about the edge and what's vital and stuff like that, it's like, I think as things approach what affects change on the ground is the metric for that. And $20,000 bikes are incredible. And this is a whole different level than, I mean, there's only a couple people in the world playing the game that you're playing here. It's just very hard to enter. This relies on precision machining, which, while cheap Chinese or offshore orders for machined goods has changed, the real game is being played in 3D printing.
This is true.
Right. And to me, that's where the real fear comes from, because that's the easiest entry point for a 16-year-old kid.
Interesting.
I guess I don't see the threat coming from this end of the spectrum.
The threat, you mean of like being replaced? Or what are we done?
Being rendered irrelevant.
Right. Well, knowledge can't be rendered irrelevant. As long as you're creating knowledge, you're not going to be rendered irrelevant.
Well, the thing is, it's like, there's only a certain amount of time you get to run in the front of the pack.
Right.
Well, eating dust is not the creating of knowledge.
Yeah, but at the same time, not a lot of races, you don't get to the front and stay there a lot of times. Sometimes you get knocked back. Sometimes you come back up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I spent a fucking decade with my tail between my legs.
Sure.
Because of all the fucking carnage I'd created.
Sure.
And I got to come back. Like, I, you know, there's a point when, like, people were saying really amazing things about me back in the early 2000s.
Right.
And then they found out I was a fucking complete screwball at that point.
Right.
Like, oh, yeah, forget this kid.
I guess, from my perspective,
that's what I'm saying. You don't have one shot.
Sure.
That's the beauty of it.
I just feel I'm not going to be able to come back. I don't have the energy to come back.
Well, eventually, yeah. But are you really there? Do you not think that you're doing work that is like...
Oh, no, no. I'm right there right now.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm at my peak. I'm creating new stuff and I'm still going. I don't think that there's much of a future there. I don't know.
Well, and on a long enough timeline, we're all disposable.
That's true.
You know, and I just think it's enjoying it while we're here. You know what I mean? It's right. Like, it's the, yeah, of course.
It's a thrilling game to play.
It is.
I think it's
especially when you play it well.
I'm stoked to be able to play it the way I am. You know? And that's what's cool about here. We come from very different directions and we're doing very different things, but in overlapping concepts. In a way, and it's kind of cool.
That's what I love about the bike industry.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can be at both ends of it, and it's, yeah.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up.
Okay.
We're going to start driving to Salida. I appreciate the time. This is going to be a huge
thing. It was my pleasure, Pete.
I need to take one or two more photos and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, there's some good stuff to take pictures.
Okay, we're going to close it down. Thank you.
Thanks, Pete.
Oh, wait. How do I turn it off?